Yes, yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the July 18th, 2017 meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. I wonder if you'd please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. May we have the roll call of members, please.
Mr. Morey?
Here.
Ms. Robertson has asked to be excused. Mr. Sigler?
Here.
Mr. Stein?
Here.
Mr. Burbank?
Here.
Ms. Chalk is also asked to be excused. Mr. Dennis?
Here.
Mr. John?
Here.
Ms. Kellis?
Here.
Ms. Kiefer?
Present.
Mr. Klein?
Here.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Present.
Mr. McKenna?
Here.
Mr. Lane?
Here.
12 members present.
We have quorum. Presentation of proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices.
Communications are on the desks.
Brief presentations to start out with. Right before our meeting, we had a small reception in honor of our new Tompkins Cortland Community College president, Orinthia Montague, who is here. We've got her at the end of the table. She's also with our immediate past president, Carl Haynes. We're glad to have both of them. And we've had a chance to interact and meet with Dr. Montague. And if she wants to say anything to us, we'd be pleased to have her do that at this point. Mm-hmm. There's a microphone right there, about six inches away from it.
Can you hear me?
Yep. Yep.
Wonderful. I'd just like to take this opportunity to thank you all for the support and welcoming that I've received in this community since my arrival. Especially I'd like to thank Carl for helping me with the transition to Tompkins-Cortland Community College, and I look forward to working with all of you all as well as the community members and how we can support and encourage our students towards their student success. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your coming to visit and come back anytime you'd like.
Thank you so much.
I'm not aware of a need for an executive session tonight, Joe or Jonathan. Let's move to privilege of the floor for the public. This is the opportunity that the public has to speak to us for up to 3 minutes on any topic. We ask that if you'd like to speak, to please fill out a blue card in the back of the room and pass it forward. You're allowed 3 minutes. The rules are printed on the blue card that any individual may speak for no longer than 3 minutes. A speaker will not raise his or her voice. A speaker will not use lewd, obscene, profane, slanderous, or libelous language, or speak or act in a manner that would tend to incite a breach of the peace. A speaker will not speak about county personnel matters. Personnel matters include comments about job performance of named county employees other than elected officials. After 3 minutes, a speaker will leave the microphone and yield the floor. Transferring time to another person is not permitted. If a speaker causes a disruption and is asked to leave, the speaker will leave the chambers. We have a countdown clock showing the 3 minutes. At the end of the 3 minutes, there will be an audible ring. If you're still speaking, we ask you to please conclude. Forgot to point out that our emergency exits are to my right at the back of the room, to my left in the front of the room. If you have cell phones or other electronic devices, please silence them. I have, at this point, 3 cards. First one is Karen Yearwood. After that, Heather Campbell. Please come to a microphone.
Hello. My name is Karen Yearwood at Village at Ithaca. I am the executive director of Village at Ithaca. Have you ever heard of the African proverb, which I believe you have? It takes a whole village to raise, educate, inspire, and affirm a child. Well, Village at Ithaca was formed on this premise 15 years ago in 2002, and we have been advocating for equity and excellence within Ithaca Public Schools by providing programs for students and families, developing strategic relationships with the school district and other community organizations, and ensuring that all students, particularly African American, Latino, low-income students and their families, meet or exceed educational equity within the school district and ensure that they meet or exceed New York State standards of education. So we have received county funding in the past, and we are seeking funding again for next year. We do several programs and services to attract families and to connect them to ensure that they are successful, especially given within this community. We're within Ithaca, where there are three large institutions, educational institutions, so there shouldn't be an achievement gap, and all students should have the opportunity. But at times, we have students and families that are marginalized from different opportunities within the school district. We provide a family advocacy program where we connect families to a volunteer community member who is trained to help advocate and help the family navigate through the school system. We provide a student success center, which is a year-round tutoring program for students K through 12. And we even have a program, our summer program, a five-week summer achievement program that's happening right now, where we connect many students that don't get the academic assistance and the remediation help that they should through the school district, and they're connected with volunteer achievement coaches that we have. And we train all of our volunteers. And at the moment, this is our sixth year for our summer achievement program. We have 39 students enrolled in the program. We started 6 years ago with two students. We serve over 90-odd students and sometimes even 110 students within 1 year. And we work within Ithaca Public Schools, as well as we have families in Groton, Newfield, Trumansburg, you name it. We have families and we connect to services. And families have said that of our family advocacy program, that they're grateful for an advocate because the advocate listened to them when no one else did. So thank you for your continued support of Village at Ithaca. We're at 609 West Clinton Street, and you could always visit us on our website, as well as I have some pamphlets if you'd be interested in seeing some of the work that we do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Heather Campbell, then Christine Carrero.
Hello. My name is Heather Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Advocacy Center. Our agency has also received county support for many years and is seeking it again this year. This is actually the 40th anniversary of the Advocacy Center. Many of you may still remember us by our old name, the Task Force for Battered Women and Child Sexual Abuse Project. So this is our 40th year of providing comprehensive services to victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and child sexual abuse across the county. Last year, we provided support and services to 1,336 people in Tompkins County, and we know those were just the folks who found us, who reached out to us. We hear from people every week who tell us, I've never told anyone this before. This is the first time I'm reaching out for services, so that we know that there's a greater need out there for services. Our 24-hour hotline answered over 1,800 calls from people, and we're available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We're one of two 24-hour hotlines in the county, the other being suicide prevention. And so we're there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week with our trained staff and also our trained hotline volunteers. And just another snapshot in terms of the scope in the community. Last year, our advocates helped over 100 victims of domestic violence receive an order of protection through family court. So we are providing active, comprehensive services to crime victims every day in this community. We provide a tremendous amount of emotional support and ongoing support, walking with people through whatever process they're going through, but also providing confidential domestic violence shelter, advocacy, help with legal issues, social services, and trying to increase safety and decrease trauma. We also do a tremendous amount of education in the community. Last year, our educators provided 333 programs for almost 5,000 people in the community. We're in every school district in Tompkins County, in the middle and high school, all three college campuses, with community members and professionals. There's a couple of updates and trends that I want to just speak to briefly. One is we've continued, I spoke about this in the past, we've continued to collaborate with Tompkins County Youth Services on the commercially sexually exploited youth outreach and services, including this year doing trainings in the community for professionals, including partnering with probation department in Tompkins County to do a training for all of the county dispatchers. And what was and we saw the impact of that training pretty much immediately. By raising the awareness of dispatchers, we were able to identify more cases of concern. And so we're looking to continue to spread that throughout that training and that awareness throughout the community in the next coming year. I also wanted to just speak very, very briefly about some trends we've seen in our shelter, is that in the last 10 years, we had seen the length of stay in our shelter increase. And that's not surprising. We all talk about housing in this county constantly. I talk about housing constantly. And this is really a safety issue for victims of domestic violence. If we don't have safe housing for people to relocate to, it decreases their safety. It increases the likelihood that they may stay in an unsafe situation. In 2013, we had an AmeriCorps who helped us with housing. We saw the impact of that. We were this year able to pull together state funds to fund that program as an ongoing program. We've seen the length of stay for our hardest to serve families decrease from 225 to 150 days. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Christine Carrero, did I pronounce that right? Yes. And Bonnie Dawson.
My name is Christine Carrero. I'm the Director of Construction Services at Better Housing for Tompkins County and Ithaca Neighborhood Housing. My name is Christine Carrero from Ithaca Neighborhood Housing and Better Housing for Tompkins County. First, I'd like to mention how appreciative we are of the ongoing support of the county for our Tompkins County Repair Program over many years by providing funding and keeping us going. Again, this year we're requesting funding to help support our unique program that provides home repairs for low-income seniors and persons with disabilities throughout the county, including people living in mobile home parks, which are fairly hard to serve because our larger grants are restricted that way because they don't own property. We provide professional skilled labor to do the repairs at no cost to the clients, and they do pay for their materials when they can. We raise money in a small fund to pay for their materials when they literally have no money at all. One of the main goals is to keep Tompkins County residents, as they age, in their homes, in place where they really want to be, and provide a healthy and safety environment for them. In addition to the repairs that we do that are requested of us, every home gets a comprehensive inspection throughout the entire home, because lots of times the clients are not aware of dangerous situations, so we can also remedy those things. We concentrate on trip hazards, anything to do with falls, CO detectors, smoke detectors, checking electrical issues, and just making whatever repairs we can that will make them age in place. The program's been running since 2001, and over the years we've consistently assisted between 50 and 100 homes, depending on the size of the repairs. Sometimes we do full wheelchair ramps that are very time-consuming and costly. Sometimes we do very small repairs. It's really a great gamut. We almost always have at least 25 people on our waiting list. And as baby boomers age, we just expect the need for our program to increase. We're seeing that already. I want to thank you for your assistance you provide in making the program possible. And I'd like to quickly, if I have time, read a couple notes from our clients. I think I might get one in. To everyone at Better Housing, especially Louis Gunn, who did all the work, I think I have the best steps in the whole mobile home park in McLean. Thank you for the wonderful new steps. They are making my life so much easier. Thank you for the new higher toilet. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you again. You have no idea how much you are appreciated. We get these notes constantly.
Thank you for sharing that with us. Bonnie Dawson, then Cal Snow.
Hi, I'm Bonnie Dawson, and I live in Groton, New York, and I've been here a few times over the last probably 25 years or more, and I just gave Kathy Culver a letter that she's going to email all of you tomorrow. I'm asking for some help as a former employee, and also I'm here tonight, and I don't really want to get into that letter while I'm here talking, but when you see it, I had no internet. And I have no computer anymore, and I did the letter on my phone, and I went in to make corrections, and I couldn't print the letter again. It wouldn't allow me to. So it's not because I don't know how to write a letter. So just keep that in mind. But I don't want to talk about the letter right now. I want to talk about what happened between the last time I saw you and now. I went into a fair hearing with CPS and a state judge, and the supervisor of CPS had an attorney from the county, and I had no attorney because I can't afford an attorney, and you don't get an attorney appointed to you. And I asked the supervisor to please define abuse. The judge says that wasn't necessary. I wasn't charged with abuse. So I asked him to define neglect and maltreatment. The supervisor gives this big, long definition of neglect and maltreatment, and then says at the end of it, as society accepts today, or something to the effect of how what society will allow today. And I asked him to define society. The judge jumped in and said there is no need for that, and he corrected the supervisor's definition of neglect and maltreatment. The supervisor didn't even know what the proper definition of neglect and maltreatment is. Then the judge went on to say that these people are very poorly educated. If they need to be trained like the state police are trained, is what he said. And he said his job would be a lot easier if the workers at CPS were trained this way the state police are trained, because they're very poorly educated, and they think there's more room within that law for them to decide what is right and what is wrong than the federal government actually gives them. So they're assuming they have more power than what they actually have. And that's the reason for all these kids in foster care. It's the reason for all these indicated reports. It's the reason for all the corruption that's going on within our CPS system and our children being taken. And I really, really am begging to have a committee set up to investigate this, because we have so many kids in foster care. And in 2016, Tompkins County adopted out 16 children. Zero of them were adopted to family members. And there's a reason. It's called Article 440, Section 4, and that's how social services gets a lot of their money. Thank you, you guys. Have a good night.
Thank you. Cal Snow. And Mark Whitmer.
First, I'd like to say thank you for the honorable work.
Can you adjust that mic up a little bit?
Sorry. First, I'd like to say thank you for the honorable work you all do and kept the ball rolling here for 200 years. I'd also like to put in that my family's got you beat by 1 year. But I'm here today in support of the county contributing money to facilitate a conservation easement with the Finger Lakes Land Trust on the Lounsbury Farm in the town of Caroline. It's a very desirable and valuable piece of property. I would like to see it stay open and agricultural. And the way this has to happen in today's age is it sure helps with some sort of conservation easement and what goes with it. Too often what happens is families age out in heritage. The property's divvied up. The heirs want to maximize its value. And in this day and age, the only way that is through commercial development. And once it's been commercially developed, it never, never goes back. So I think there's a benefit to the land. There's also through the water that there's buffering strips along the city's water supply, Six Mile Creek, so that it permits management and site by the Finger Lakes Land Trust to see that this is managed in what I think will be the county's benefit over time. So I hope you will consider it positively and move forward with it. And do I have any other notes here? It's a well-suited farm that would be possible for a variety of agricultural uses. You could ask, well, why is somebody named Snow here? Well, I've been working that land for 30 years. It could be a vegetable farm. Right now we're a small dairy farm. We just use it to raise forage crops for our dairy farm. But it would also, you know, be suited for a fruit farm, truck farm, you know, sort of a big CSA or whatever. So it's a valuable, diverse piece of ground, and so I hope you will consider it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mark Whitmer, supervisor.
Hi, I'm Mark Whitmer, town supervisor in Caroline, and I agree with what Cal just said. I just want to let you know, I provided a letter that I drafted. The Caroline Town Board has unanimously endorsed this project for a conservation easement on the Lounsbury Tract. I think it really has a lot of benefits. It's agricultural land, productive agricultural land that's in use. There's woodland that will be protected along Six Mile Creek, so the stream will be buffered from stormwater impacts. It'll provide wildlife habitat. It'll protect the stream from erosion and runoff and the protect the water quality for Ithaca. So, I just want to. This project is also really emphasizes a main theme of the 2006 comprehensive plan of the town of Caroline, which is to maintain and strengthen the rural nature of the town. And so, by I think this project will protect agricultural land. It'll protect the stream, and in so doing, it'll protect open space. So thank you very much for considering this. We strongly endorse it. So.
Thank you. Now, that's my last blue card. Is there anyone else that wants to hand up a blue card? All right. Thank you for your comments. Next, we have privilege of the floor for municipal officials. Other than Supervisor Whitmer, if you'd like to report on Caroline, you're welcome to. I don't know if we have any other ones here tonight. Is that a yes? You're welcome. Thank you.
I had a brief board meeting before my report. So we are excited about the easement proposal. Let's see, what's in the news in Caroline? We bought a grade all, so that was our big purchase this summer, which was sort of a mind-boggling purchase, but we did it. The old grade all was something like 23 years old, and we felt like it was a better investment to move towards a new one and retire the old one instead of repairing it. I have been working with Administrator Mariana on the shared services, expedited shared services program, and so that's been going very well. Joe's been doing a great job, and I appreciate that. We are, it's over a year ago that I brought up the proposal for a trail extension on the South Hill Recway Trail extension in Caroline. So that's generated a lot of community discussion, and as I've mentioned before, it's tremendously improved attendance at town board meetings. And we are still working on that issue. I will mention that we have it. The town website has a page for trail information, and I posted some documents there that are of interest and primarily centered around the nagging question that's been posed about ownership by NYSEG of the trail. So I recently posted the legal analysis that was done by our town attorney. So it's informative and interesting. So that's about all I have to say. Any questions?
Questions, Will.
With more comment, I'm sorry that the trail has been as controversial. I know that is frequently the case wherever they are being proposed. I really want to thank those of you who have been working to make this happen and try to allay the concerns that people have. I think there it will be a wonderful resource if that trail can be extended. So I won't come to your board meeting because I don't think you want outsiders, but I think it's I certainly would look forward to using it if it's ever extended.
Okay. Thank you, and we welcome anybody at the board meetings, actually. So.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions? Mark, the Bicentennial Commission, I know, would very much like to arrange a time to come out and dedicate the historic marker in Caroline. And so we'd like to work with you on a time that we could do that.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
And I just follow up on the trail issue. You know, I agree with what Will said about I sort of look forward to engaging with people for, a true dialogue and sort of, information exchange or actually grappling with concerns that people have. And I will say that we've received a tremendous amount of positive support, too. So, great. Thank you.
Anna.
Just a quick question about timeline. Do you have a sense of when you plan on voting for that, for the trail, support or against?
My own personal feeling is, and I haven't discussed it with the board, the next step would be to say, yeah, we'll look at and craft a plan. And it would be non-binding. So I think that's the next board discussion. So I, beyond that, I can't really say. But it has been a year. I think we have all the information we need. We all understand it pretty well. There's a 2009 trails document that's very informative that the previous Caroline Trails Committee produced. We know what the concerns are of people, so we can talk with them about those concerns. So I think we're ready for that.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you again.
Yep, thank you.
Privilege of the floor for legislators. Jim Dennis.
One more grassroots. It starts on Thursday, but it's had an early start this year. It seemed to start Sunday night, according to the baseline that I was hearing for a very long time.
Anyone else? Dave McKenna.
Yeah, I'd just like to invite everybody to Newfield Old Home, May 28th and 29th. Parade starts at 11 morning Saturday morning.
We're going to bring the cake, I think. Hey. I see Marcia nodding over there. Less than it being Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the opportunity to attend an event at our courthouse, our former chambers, back on June 13th, and I meant to share this information with the legislature because I thought it was exciting news. So in January of this year, New York State Unified Court System opened and commissioned the Richard C. Fala LGBTQ Commission. It's housed the headquarters in New York City. And I was going to share this in my WDIC report because I thought the mission was quite interesting. So the mission of this commission, part of it, is to protect and enhance diversity and promote the presence of the LGBTQ judicial and non-judicial personnel within the unified court system. Interesting enough, in attending that event, one of the things that the judges who were there, who were openly members of the LGBT community and other participants, shared things as simple as looking at the forms used by the court system that still asked people to identify as male or female, and how do we change that language that it is gender neutral and inclusive. So these are some of the things that the commission is working on, and it just reminded me of some of the work that we're doing here within our own county. Of course, our court systems are a little behind the curve, but they're getting there. So it was exciting to hear about this commission. It's exciting to follow up on some of the work they have been doing, and especially in also trying to get members of the LGBT community in employment within our court system, not those who are individual practicing attorneys, but in many of the jobs that are available that often they are not getting into. So I just wanted to share that information as we continue to do our work in looking at our forms and looking at all the things that we're doing in promoting inclusion. It is good to see our court system moving in this direction as well. And for those of you who don't know, Judge Richard C. Fela was notably the first openly gay person to be appointed first as a judge to criminal court and then to Supreme Court in New York State. And so this commission is named in his honor.
Thank you. I thought I saw another hand. Rich.
Thank you, Mike. I just wanted to give a shout-out to Catholic Charities. They had an open house today showcasing all the different services that they provide in our community, including refugee support, health insurance sign-ups, helping people walk through that process. They have clothing donations. They have support for people going through issues with the Child Protective Services that we were hearing about just a few minutes ago. And they help people sign up for the SNAP program. And so they're touching our community in a lot of different ways. And I wanted to mention, I picked up a flyer for something they're having on October 21st, which sounded interesting, out at St. Catherine of Siena Parish Center, which is a poverty simulation, where they try to explain how difficult it is to get through all of the things you have to do in a month on a very limited budget. And with limited transportation and other factors. So it sounds like it'll be an eye-opening experience for anybody interested in going and seeing the simulation. Anyway, they do a lot of good work in our community, and it was nice to go to the open house. Thank you.
Mike Sigler.
I'll be quick. I just I wanted to thank, actually, the jail committee. I mean, big report came out, obviously. Very exciting. It's going to be handled this week. Not stealing his thunder, but you didn't mention it. So Thursday at 5, so very encouraging report and very interesting if you get a chance to read it. Also, I want to thank my town board in Lansing and the village board and Cayuga Heights as well. They actually passed an MOU this week. Finally, the village of Lansing passed it. Before that, the Cayuga Heights village had passed it, and the town had already passed this to extend the sewer line from about where the mall is right now up into Lansing. So it looks like, thanks to some hard work by the town board and Ed Levine and by some developers who want this and would be paying for this, that we may be extending that that sewer line up there, which is like giant for the town. So very encouraging news there, and something that we were never able to get past just because of the expense in the town. It looks like hopefully we've had some real progress there. So that looks good.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Mr. Chair, can I just add a little quick something
sure.
to grassroots? Thank you, Jim, for mentioning grassroots. I just want to remind people that aside from grassroots that's happening this weekend, we still have in downtown Ithaca, yes, it's my district, I have to talk about it, the summer concert series that happens. All of us need a break in the summertime to go enjoy some good music. So go to grassroots. And tomorrow, Wednesday, instead of Thursday, summer concert series is happening. And if you go to Grassroots on Sunday at 5 o'clock, shutting down the show, you'll see a name that says Mr. McBean. Yes, he's related to me. Go check him out, because he's bad.
I can't think of a county that has a bigger social calendar, more events than Tompkins County. And it's... It would be nice if we could go to all of them, but they're wonderful. We have so many talented people here. Shall we move on? We have a special presentation tonight. I'm going to invite Ed Marks and Scott Doyle up from the Planning Department to talk about our Tompkins County Natural Infrastructure Capital Project Update. While they're coming up, we're going to drop the screens. We're trying. Jim, can we lower the lights? There. Thank you.
Great. Thanks a lot. Good evening, everyone. I'm here with Scott Doyle, Associate Planner, who's been working on this program to talk about the Natural Infrastructure Capital Program that the legislature approved in the capital plan last year and in the budget for the first year this year to allocate $200,000 per year to invest in our natural infrastructure. We put a lot of investments into other aspects of our infrastructure. This is a component that had long been overlooked in some ways, and we're now, as a county, making a commitment to make an investment. I think that's really important. So why invest in natural infrastructure? One of the main reasons for bringing this program forward now is to respond to and prepare for the impacts of climate change. We are witnessing what may be, you know, weather is weather, climate is another story, but the relationships of what we're seeing and the patterns of weather are aligning with what's being predicted for a future climate in this community. We're seeing that the rainfall is coming in much more intensive events, and we've certainly seen plenty of examples of that in the last couple of weeks here. And that will continue and intensify over time as climate change progresses. Natural infrastructure, the natural features in our landscape, our forests, our wetlands, our floodplains, can help us adapt to and deal with these problems. And avoid some of the more catastrophic flooding events that we could otherwise experience. And so this investment is a long-term investment. It will take many years to fully realize it, but it will make a difference in the long term for the community as we see these events occurring. It also, at the same time, helps us protect water quality because these heavy storms also tend to flush a lot of contaminants into the water streams and that end up in our water supplies. So to the extent we can mitigate that, we're also protecting our water supplies. And we have several components of the program that will deal with that. So let's get into a little bit about what this program is designed to address. When we presented it last year, we outlined this, but we're really into implementing the program now. So as a reminder, looking at ways of protecting those systems that mitigate the impacts of intensive rainfall events. That can include floodplains, intact forests in the watersheds, wetlands that can absorb a lot more moisture in a high rain event. Protecting the quality of water in our streams, aquifers, and Cayuga Lake, all the sources of water supply in this community. Folks get water from the lake. They get it from streams such as Six Mile Creek and Fall Creek in public water supplies there, and we also have communities that tap into groundwater aquifers for their water supplies. So all of those are included in the Natural Infrastructure Program. And again, decreasing sediment loads that can come with high runoff events and end up ultimately in the lake. We know we have a huge issue in Cayuga Inlet and the flood control channel with necessary dredging that needs to be done, very expensive and costly. We can decrease the amount of sediment reaching those areas with this program over time. So this is just a little example, a model of a watershed from Massachusetts. Actually, ours is in better shape than this one here. We have better forests in our upland areas. But just an idea of the kinds of things that we're looking at, focusing on here. The forests in their upper watersheds, where they're intact, they can hold a lot of water and have it run off much more slowly if it's coming down in an area that's forested. So we want to protect those forests in the upper watershed in particular is where we can. And there's the stream corridors and floodplains, the areas where the runoff collects. Many cases are natural floodplains, which geologically we know were places where floods were would naturally spread out, are no longer functioning that way. Water, streams have been incised and cut down in a way that they channel the water quickly downstream instead of spreading out in the floodplains. There's things we can do to restore the function of those floodplains. And then also for our groundwater, we've been doing over, let's see, almost 15 years now, I think, aquifer studies with local municipalities. We know a lot more about our groundwater resources, where they get recharged, where the rainfall infiltrates and recharges those water supplies. In some cases, we may need to protect that area so it won't be contaminated. So how do we protect natural infrastructure? What kind of tools does this resource that the legislature has allocated allow us to look at? Conservation easements are a big part of it, where property stays in private ownership, but it may be under easement to stay as a forest land, managed forest land, for the benefit of the property owner and of the economy. Wetlands and stream corridors that can be protected so that they can perform their natural functions without impairment. As I mentioned just a minute ago, reconnecting floodplains to the streams to the floodplains so that when there's a big flood event, big rainfall event, the water can spread out and gradually run off compared to what it would without the floodplain functioning. And that can reduce the velocity and the damage that comes from a flood event, as well as the actual amount of water that reaches downstream locations at any one point in time. Restoration of stream banks, establishment of buffers. We've learned over the years, we've done a lot of work here to study and look at the most recent research that suggests what's needed in terms of a buffer along a stream to maintain water quality in the stream, as well as habitat and reduce erosion on that stream. And then so we have started work on establishing stream buffers previously. This program may help us accelerate that work. And things that we can do on our county properties, such as our county roads or even county facilities, road ditches, for example, have been identified by Cornell Local Roads Program as a huge water quality issue. A lot of water runs through those ditches, ends up in streams, and often carries a lot of sediment and can carry contaminants with it. Different methods of constructing ditches and managing them can reduce the amount of material that's carried in that water into streams. And then, as I mentioned, protection of our aquifer recharge areas, again, particularly areas around wellheads where there's public water supplies in the aquifers, those areas should be kept clear of inappropriate land uses, and often the area right around the wellhead or in a recharge area should be protected permanently. So the program was approved by the legislature last year in the budget. Earlier this year, we worked with the Planning, Development, and Environmental Quality Committee to develop guidelines for the program and how we would develop projects. We then established a committee of our Planning Advisory Board. We're lucky to have folks with great expertise there who can help guide and give advice on projects that might be brought forward to the legislature. We have started developing projects. You'll see a couple of them tonight. And we're looking now, in summer of this year, 7 months into the program, starting to actually make some recommendations for how we might allocate some of this funding. Many of these projects will take a long time to develop because they're kind of new and quite large scale compared to things we've done in the past, but we have a lot of things in development. We're going to talk about that a little bit. So the three big watersheds in Tompkins County are Fall Creek, Six Mile Creek, and Cayuga Inlet, and they're the most significant ones for the issues we're talking about, although all the watersheds do share these issues. Fall Creek, Cornell Water Supply, Six Mile Creek, the cities, Cayuga Inlet, huge area, largest watershed, I think, and also, you know, the Cayuga flood control channels at the bottom. So those are all really important. Six Mile Creek, to start with, you heard earlier from a couple of speakers about a project there that would provide an easement over property along Six Mile Creek and maintain a forested vegetated buffer along the stream. And that's a project we're proposing tonight for you to take some action on. There's also a couple other projects kind of in the early stages of development that Scott's been working on, including additional easements on stream corridors upstream on Six Mile Creek and some private forest land easements that could protect the watershed. And so this is the one project that's going to be before you tonight. The Lounsbury Tract, the farm in the town of Caroline, Six Mile Creek, you can see on the photo, in just this side of the road on the top end of the photo, that all that forested buffer on the farm is really important to protecting water quality there. And in this project, we would also look to enhance some of the buffer where it's not quite as wide as it should be in that area. This is a project that we're looking for a little bit of funding from the county and the city to match much larger investment by the state of New York, which has established for the first time this year a water source protection program. And there's several million dollars been allocated statewide for that, and we, working with the Finger Lakes Land Trust, hope to acquire funding to support an easement on this farm. In Fall Creek, we're looking at conservation of a farm that has a significant wetland on the property. We also are looking at some floodplain forest land that may in the future be available for protection and some in a couple different places. And one of the places would include some restoration work in the stream where there's been some damage. So this is the project here, the Prince Brotherton Farm in the town of Dryden. Etna Swamp is a unique natural area, designated natural area, that drains directly into Fall Creek. Those wetlands perform an important function of collecting runoff from adjacent farmlands and kind of filtering that runoff before it gets into the stream. And in this project, there would be additional buffer around the swamp provided as part of the project. And in the course of doing this, also the rest of the farm would be protected, which the property owner's been wanting to do. Cayuga Inlet Watershed. We have no project to propose at this time, but several are in the works that we're working on, including connecting the stream to a natural floodplain, doing some stream bank restoration, and also a project or two that might work with County Highway on some of these ditch management methods we've been talking about earlier. So there's a part of Cayuga Inlet right near the state park. There's several projects in this stretch. It's also constrained a little bit here by the railroad track that runs along it. So it's a very dynamic and kind of challenging area to work in. But we've done some studies already that suggest there's some real opportunities to improve the function of the floodplain in this area, reduce sediment loading into the stream. And that's projects we hope to bring forward in the future. So Scott's the lead on this. If you have questions, feel free to get in touch with Scott. And if you have questions now, we'd be happy to try to respond to them. You've got a couple of resolutions coming up later.
Yes, we have questions. Will.
Thanks for this presentation. It's a really good overview, Ed. You mentioned the whole sort of trying to change the practices relative to ditches. And, of course, the county only has some of the ditches that the towns and villages have their own and the state. What is the best practice currently? Because in times past, I was told that ditches were actually better than the fast-moving pipes that some communities have put in. Is it putting rocks and such to slow the water down? Or what?
Well, you know, first of all, keeping them vegetated is one thing.
Yeah.
We, you know, some management techniques have involved scraping the ditch, and then it was often exposed for a period of time, and then there would get rains, and that sediment would all move down the ditch into the
stream. And they're still doing that, I can
tell
you.
It does happen.
Yes.
It still does happen. So, but I know County Highway and Soil and Water Conservation District have done a lot in terms of hydro-seeding those after mm-hmm. that's done so that they get vegetation back on them quicker. Scott, you might want to respond with some of the other ideas.
You know, as you mentioned, Cornell Local Roads has done a lot of work on this and a lot of research on campus, but things like various check dams depend a lot on the situation, the landscape. Sometimes there's a recommendation to actually pull water off of the road in sections if appropriate. There's different filtration techniques, you know, even discussions of compost sections or woody debris to break up that. A lot of this work's been down in the Northwest for all the rain they deal with, but it's real situational. And so this is a conversation that's happened at the local town levels as well. But I think we have a great opportunity and great leadership at County Highway to help advance these projects there too.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Anna.
Just trying to understand the program for myself as I'm supporting it and watching it grow. You have targeted areas that you want to protect. Do you seek out private property to speak to them about possible easements? Do people connect with you? Do you have a map that you guys have created that's like the long-term goal that you've established for protection, and then you're sort of working forward towards that? I'm just trying to get a sense of how you get parcels and identify target areas.
I'll give you the overview, and Scott can give you the details of how he's working on this, but... Yes, we have areas that we've identified in the past as really target areas where there's a significant resource or a problem that could be managed or corrected. And those are the areas. We've done watershed studies for all of these watersheds. And we had consultants that walked every inch of those watersheds and identified us for us where some of the problems that they saw were. So those are some of the target areas. We know where there's opportunities to protect, you know, intact floodplain forests, things like that. So we have some ideas, but some projects get generated by others as well. And Scott can talk about how some of these are coming about.
Yeah, one of the great things about this investment is it's really changing the discussions, relationships we've been able to have in the community to, you know, come to a discussion with the landowner that maybe has been interested in something in the past but couldn't financially, you know, help to protect the property. One of the examples here is the Lonsbury one that you'll analyze tonight. That's one that she's been really interested in advancing protection, and what we're proposing is leveraging a small portion of our money, a little bit of the city's as well, to pull a whole bunch of money from the state to do that. And we just haven't been able to do that in the past. So it's just a lot of this engagement with private property owners in maybe a different way than we've been doing that before. But it's a kind of combination of this envisioning with longer-term ideas for, hey, where is going to be the best type of investment for these large-scale investments of different types of projects, both built and protected?
So I have two other small questions, if that's all right. I'm trying to put them in the right order. What percentage of the land that you guys have identified to be in this long-term goal is private property currently? Do you have a sense of that? Is a majority of it already private property? Or because I saw a bunch in conservancies. So there was Cornell was a huge chunk, and there was the Finger Lakes Land Trust that already had pieces of your target areas. So I was sort of wondering, at least for now, are you primarily targeting private property? And the reports or the projects that we have right now, several of them had functions still happening on them, like this one had farming still happening. Are you working with these landowners to identify then practices for the types of farming that would be allowed once we did make them protected so that they can continue to do it? So is that also part of the negotiation?
It can be. In general, what we're focused on is maintaining the buffers in this program of the water resources. And, you know, the easement would maintain that it's going to be kept in agriculture. Mm-hmm. As was mentioned earlier, the type of agriculture might change. And, you know, there's a lot of folks working, so on Water Conservation District works with farmers on issues, if there are issues that they need to manage on the property. But the agriculture type could change, but we would maintain always the buffer and might even be able to work on some other improvements on the farm that would improve overall water quality.
So then the farming would end at a certain point that you agree on. Okay, thank you.
Mike Sigler.
We talked about this at the meeting, and I'm just curious. I'm going to support the Lounsbury thing mostly because of the creek. I mean, that's really important to me. I'm wondering, going forward, should we be looking at spending money? And I'm going to use this as an example. I'm not suggesting that's what this Lounsbury farm would be used for, into almost like the reestablishment of floodplains, not maybe historic floodplains, but ones that we could actually build. Like if the Lounsbury farm was there, I mean, I know people want to keep it for farming, but if we were to reestablish a floodplain on that property, and again, not suggesting that, just saying as an example. I mean, obviously, I guess the closer we got downstream, the better it would be. But I'm just thinking like Seneca Lake. I mean, part of the reason they don't have a problem is they got a giant wetland, and on the other end of the lake, they probably have less of a problem because, again, Montezuma absorbs a lot of water. So I didn't know if that's something we were looking at, considering.
Well, it's kind of a hybrid thing. I mean, when we talk about restoring natural floodplains, it's almost what you end up doing because the geology is, things have changed so much. When the land was all, you know, all the forests were removed and a lot of the morphology of these streams changed dramatically. So you're kind of trying to reestablish a floodplain. It's almost like building a floodplain in some cases. So the idea you got is right. You know, you find the best places where the water could spread out and be held for a little while. And it may be often where there was a floodplain, it might in some cases be someplace else. So you're right.
And those are some excellent, there's some excellent projects and sites that we're actively working on that would do just that, that I hope to have that conversation. I think those are very impactful potentially to basically change how that works or restore how that works.
I mean, even the end of the lake is pretty shallow now, right?
Well, it's in danger of becoming a wetland if we don't do something about the sediment coming in.
But would that necessarily be a bad thing?
We'll see, I guess. not in our lifetimes, but.
Peter Stein.
Hi. I hope you won't see this as trivial, okay, but I have what I think is an important comment. I think nobody should use either red or think twice about using green on the things that they distribute here. I can't read the red, okay? I'm just passing that on.
Thank you, Peter.
It's a good point. Thank you.
Leslin.
So thank you for the overview, but I need a little more guts. I'm trying to understand this. So can you go back a couple of slides for me? There was one with stormwater. Go back. Right there. So my biggest question is, who was doing this work? How was this being done? Help me understand. I'm not sure I'm following.
Sure. Well, we're the focal point for the work in the county on this particular program, but we're always working with partners. So we work Soil and Water Conservation District, Finger Lakes Land Trust, our planning advisory board members, which includes engineers and other folks with expertise, in other municipalities. So we're not doing it in isolation.
Okay. So the monies that the county that we set aside or we voted on for this, so if the municipalities, the Soil and Water Conservation District, whoever it is, says there are things that they're doing, are those proposals then coming to you all and then you're making that distribution of the funds?
What we're doing is working with folks to formulate proposals, and that involves working with landowners as well as other partners to do that. And we bring those to the Planning Advisory Board committee that was appointed to be the committee to assist us with this. They give us the go-ahead to work on it, bring it to final form to bring it then to the Planning Committee, PDEC committee. And then from there it comes here. So it's been through several kind of review processes, and we're the entity that's keeping the big picture to make sure these all are fitting pieces of a puzzle that fit into the concept for this program.
Thank you. And then please forgive me the simplicity in my questioning because I'm trying to understand this. So if I were to take, which is the one that intrigues me the most, innovative stormwater management techniques. So these municipalities, whoever it is, that put together a proposal that here are some things we need to mitigate this. That's how that's going to happen.
That has happened. Let me give an example of where the town and the county highway folks have come together and suggested, here's a area we got a problem. Can we come up with a plan to fix it?
Yeah. And what I might see happening in this type of program is, working with county highway to identify a stretch of road ditch they're having an issue with. If there's a differential in the cost to implement a different new technique, that's something that we would bring and consider through that path and then consider for funding as well. But, yeah, we've tried a couple of those different types of things already, and this, I think, will help to add further enhance those types of investments.
Okay. And then my last thing, please, don't shoot the messenger, or at least warn me so I can duck. The city of Ithaca had its own storm water management plan, and some of that costs for doing this got sent back to the residents.
I know.
You know.
We both live in the city. I think we're both
know. So is that something that's potential consideration so that there's not always coming to the county looking for the funding to support to make these things happen, maintain, whatever it is?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the city, stuff flows downhill, as they say, and the city's at the bottom of all these watersheds, pretty much.
Yes.
So what we're doing is upstream, mostly, of the city, and the city, in one case, on Six Mile Creek, where their water supply is mm-hmm. being asked to contribute as well. So we're trying to do what the county can do. The city's doing a lot of work. There's a lot of issues around stormwater and flooding potentials in the city, and they're actively pursuing those. And Scott's in communication and collaboration with them on that.
Okay. Yeah, as an example, the work that Mike Thorne at the city's spearheading for, I sit on the board that, or the guidance team that's helping with the analysis for, hey, where are the different flooding pinch points in the city based on different scenarios. I hope that's going to help influence potential projects here too. Like, where's going to be the best bang for a buck and location-wise, and what's going to really have an impact? And we may talk about those types of projects to come.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Jim Dennis.
Thank you, Mike. Related to this, John Nagley and Soil and Water are constantly talking to agricultural people, farmers and the like, and they're always looking for ways to protect their property from rolling into streams. So the Soil and Water District is heavily involved, as we have funds to be involved. So
been a great partner, and look for them to continue to be.
Thank you both. It was very enlightening, and we appreciate your keeping us informed on this important issue.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Yes, we're going to put the screens up.
Katina.
I want to see more pictures.
Back in the meeting, why don't we see if we can do some resolutions and let folks go home that are out there in the audience waiting for us. Dooley, since we've been talking about planning, why don't we go to Planning Department, the resolutions here.
Certainly.
Dooley Kiefer is the Vice Chair of the Planning, Development, and Economic Environmental Quality Committee.
Well, beginning on packet page 14, there is a series of resolutions that will address our participation, I hope, in what you have just learned about tonight in the presentation. So the first one is Resolution G, making a negative determination of environmental significance in relation to Resolution number blank of 2017, appropriating funds from the Capital Reserve Fund for Natural, Scenic, and Recreational Resource Protection for the Emerald Necklace / Charles Spencer Preserve, the Ott Tract Protection Project.
Is there a second? Seconded by Leslin. Discussion. Ready to vote?
In your packet, you do have the pictures. I think that the presentation tonight made things very clear.
Let's vote. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Are there any opposed? That's unanimous.
Thank you.
Let's go to H.
Page 22.
H is packet page 22, ID 7127. Appropriating funds from the Capital Reserve Fund for Natural, Scenic, and Recreational Resources Protection for the Emerald Necklace / Charles Spencer Preserve, the Ott Tract Protection Project. Can I move it?
Second. Seconded by Rich. Discussion? Those in favor, please raise your hand. Those opposed? Again, it's unanimous. Go to I.
Resolution I, packet page 33, document ID 7131. Making a negative determination of environmental significance in relation to resolution number something of 2017. Appropriating funds from the Tompkins County Natural Infrastructure Capital Project for the Lounsbury Tract, Six Mile Creek Source Water Protection Project. I move it.
Second from Anna. Discussion? We vote. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Any opposed? Again, unanimous.
And the next one is packet page 40, document 7128, resolution J. Appropriating funds from Tompkins County Natural Infrastructure Capital Project for the Lounsbury Tract, Six Mile Creek Source Water Protection Project. Can I move it?
Seconded by Dan. Discussion?
I must say that the presentation that we just sat through made it so clear that you make my job extremely easy tonight. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Ready to vote? Those in favor, please raise your hand. Any opposed? Again, it's unanimous.
The next one is packet page 48, document ID 7133, making a negative determination of environmental significance in relation to resolution number something of 2017, appropriating funds from the Tompkins County Natural Infrastructure Capital Project for the Etna Swamped Brotherton Farm Protection Project. I move this.
Seconded by Anna. Discussion? Those in favor, raise your hand. Those opposed? Unanimous.
And finally, packet page 55, document 7129, resolution L. Appropriating funds from Tompkins County Natural Infrastructure Capital Project for the Etna Swamp Brotherton Farm Protection Project. I move this.
Seconded by Anna again. Discussion? Those in favor? Any opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you, Dooley.
Thank you. Thank you, Ed.
Who's waiting for what? Let's go to Anna for Health and Human Services. I think Resolution E.
Resolution E, appropriation of $50,000 from contingent fund to support the Ithaca Tompkins Continuum of Care Transitional Housing Plan. I'll pass. Move that.
And seconded by Leslin. Discussion.
Not much discussion, but didn't we appropriate this thing several times over?
All right. Short form roll call.
Mr. Morey?
Yes.
Mr. McKenna?
Yes.
Are there any noes? That again is unanimous.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question, please?
Yes.
So does that now mean that they get to spend the money?
Yes.
That's what it means now.
Carefully.
Okay. Carefully.
Pre-selected.
Got it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Rod Howe has returned. He was here at our last meeting, and I believe there's a resolution we may bring to the floor.
I think that's going to probably come up on resolutions to be added or withdrawn.
Okay.
But,
it's just
see if there's any. Peg, which are you here for a particular resolution? M.
ACON.
Jim, could you move Resolution M for us?
I could. Approval at Resolution M, approval of use of 2017 Arts and Cultural Organization Development, ACOD, Professional Development Funds, and I would move that.
Seconded by Glenn. Discussion. Dan Klein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to propose an amendment to this resolution that deals with the ACOD funding, and I'll have more to say about it if we get to second and we have discussion. And here is the amendment, the proposed amendment. Be it further resolved, so it would be the last resolved, be it further resolved that 2017 funding for any ACOD organizations which have received funding cuts be restored to their 2015 levels with funding to come from the STPB Reserve Fund for a total of $26,500.
Seconded by Dooley Kiefer. You want to speak to it?
Yes, please. In 2015, there were some cuts made to several arts organizations in our county, specifically the Hangar Theater, $2,500 was cut. State Theater, $2,000 was cut. Museum of the Earth / Cayuga Nature Center, $10,000 was cut. History Center, $5,000 was cut. And the Cayuga Chamber Orchestra, $7,000 was cut. That's a total of $26,500. That money was cut from these organizations because other organizations received funding, and it was said that there wasn't enough funding to go around to all these organizations. So that funding cut was in effect for 2016, and it is in effect for 2017. I've looked carefully at the STPB budget, the Strategic Tourism Planning Board's budget, that is based on the county hotel room tax, and it seems to me that there is quite a bit of money. I'm going to mention a couple of figures here briefly. The hotel tax revenues have gone up every year since 2009. There's now $1 million more collected than there was 10 years ago. Since 2011, every single quarterly amount in the hotel room tax has been greater than the previous year's quarter. And then very recently, the second quarter of 2017, revenues were released, and there's an additional $125,000 in that over the same quarter in 2016. So, I mean, those numbers far, far exceed the $26,500 that we're talking about here. These are the bedrock arts organizations of our county, and those kind of cuts mean a lot to them. It affects them a lot. So the resolution is to restore their funding in 2017. I can't go back to 2016 or I would. To restore it in 2017 and to restore them to the levels that they were at 2 years ago. And I just want to stress that doing that will not take away money from any other arts organizations. It will not cost our taxpayers a dime, and it will not stop any recommendations that are already in the STPB budget. Thank you.
Peter.
Yes, I very strongly support this resolution. I don't agree with everything that
Dan has just said. I think it may cost our taxpayers money. I don't say that very slowly. I'd have to think a lot about it, whether it's true or not. But nonetheless, I think our fundamental obligation is to do the best thing with people's money that we can do. I think I can think of a lot of things that are more important than this, but I think that we ought to do what's best for everybody. And I think, I personally believe that our county, everybody in our county, is helped by these programs, or can be helped. Nobody is hurt by these programs. So as far as I'm concerned, if you've got something where you can believe nobody's hurt, you should do it because it's the right thing to do. Unless it's so huge that you're really giving forget about it. Okay, that's what I think.
Jim Dennis.
Thank you, Mike. This came up at the Budget Committee meeting the other day, and it did not make it out of the Budget Committee meeting. Let me just do a little bit of history here. None of this money is taxpayer money. This is money that's generated by hotels and other operations that people come into this county and drop off 5% of their money here. This whole program was developed many years ago by a former county legislator and chair, Stuart Stein, in working with many other people in the community. They developed a very good group of people called STPB to run this program, to examine all the requests, to dole out the money the best way they thought to include all of these arts and culture organizations that we're looking at. And actually, we're looking at some new ones. The issue for me is that this whole group was put together to keep it out of the hands of the county legislature. It was put together with people who were in the business, being hoteliers, being involved in the arts community. And it made sense then, and it makes sense in 2017 that those people are making this decision on where the money goes. And it is troubling to me to think that now the county legislature has given these people this job to do for many years, and now we're going to meddle in it. And that's what it looks like to me. And I think we have these people out there working on our behalf with money that they generate, and we're saying to them, please do the best you can. And they've done that for many, many, many years. And it makes sense to me that, you know, I'm looking at the ones who lost money, and trust me, I have some knowledge about theater groups in Tompkins County. And if $5,000 put you in the red, then, you know, you got to look at how you fundraise, frankly. And, you know, because I know people in all of these groups, and I know what they need, and I know how they fundraise, and they do a great job at it. I don't think at 2017 numbers came to them that it was going to have a dramatic effect on what they were able to do in the community. And if you look at these, we've actually added people. So I would hope that we don't take the tack of, oh, we're gonna look over everything this group has done for many years because we know better. Frankly, we don't.
Rich John.
Well, now I'm conflicted. It seems like what the STPB did was trying to be fiscally prudent.
For the people at home, and the acronym's been used, that's the Strategic Tourism Planning Board.
Thank you, Mike, and I apologize for using the...
It's the second time that came up in the discussion. I thought we ought to say it for the folks at home.
It looks like in 2016 they were trying to use the same amount of money across more organizations.
Yes.
And so there were beneficiaries of that, and it is sharing the pie in a different way. I would love to hear from representatives of the STPB to understand what their view is of this. What Dan is saying makes perfect sense to me, but I hear Jim as well, and we shouldn't be stepping into this area if it was our intent to take this out of the political arena.
Let me just say, Tom Knipe is our person.
Rich has the floor.
Right, I understand that.
I'll stop.
And he is not here, but we have John Spencer, we have Ed Marks here, and you know, I'm certain, and Peggy, I'm certain they would be willing to entertain any questions or comments.
Do any of those folks like to speak to this?
Let me first say I agree that these arts organizations are an incredible asset to the community and deserve the support that they get. I'm not on the STPB, but I can speak for the department that supports them, that they go through an extremely thoughtful process, and many of these organizations actually are represented on the STPB, whose funding was affected. And they agreed on these funding levels and recommended them. So there was an understanding that it was important to add some new organizations that previously weren't getting any funding, and that in the total scheme of the entire tourism program would mean some reallocation of the funds to the other organizations to achieve that. And that was the decision that was made, recommended, and adopted by the legislature. So that's how we got there. And that was the reasoning behind it. Just to leave a little more history, this program was originally seen as a stabilization program that would give funding for like 3 years to an organization to go through several steps of getting their financial house in better order. And it was kind of assumed that they wouldn't get any funding after that. But recognizing the important value of all these organizations and having some revenues that they can count on, I think that the change was made that, yes, it makes sense to continue to support those organizations that have received support earlier. So that's where we stand. And the STPB, I think at the committee, some of the members were there to express their opinion about their process.
Mike?
I just wanted to ask Ed a question. I mean, obviously, we all support the arts. I mean, I was at the Hangar Theater on Friday. Great show, by the way. So sorry you missed it because it was last night. There's a new one opening soon. I wanted to ask Ed about this. I mean, it's my understanding that these organizations, even though they might be getting cut from this pot, I mean, some of them have received a lot of money from the other parts of the tourism program. I mean, some have received, I think, well in excess of like $300,000. You have to kind of look at it at the aggregate and not just this one focal point. I mean, is that about right?
And I don't have all those numbers in front of me, but I know some of them have received kind of individual grants they have to apply for new programs or projects. The tourism program is certainly trying to accomplish many things. The arts has always been one of the core parts of the program, and that's continuing. But the STP board has, you know, their job is to evaluate, make some judgments and recommendations, and then they're adopted by the legislature, and that's the budget we have that we're working with this year.
Let's see. Who? We got a lot of hands still. Rich, I think you got cut off. I'm going back to you. And I've got Dooley and then Anna. Anna, you haven't spoken, so we'll take Anna, then Dooley.
Thank you, Mike.
Leslin?
We'll get Leslin. My jazz hands.
Leslin needs a second shot, too.
I haven't spoken.
Ed, I had a follow-up. I guess what I'm trying to understand was the rationale of the STPB, and maybe you can't speak to that tonight, but did they set the numbers that they did based on thinking they had a limited amount of money? Do they think allocating the extra $26,500 would make the reserve fund unsustainable? It looks like there's enough money to do this. So I'm wondering what they were thinking in terms of let's continue the limited allocation to those arts organizations that got cut in 2015.
Yeah, it'd be hard, pressed to put myself into the minds of the folks in 2015 because I wasn't at the meeting where it was discussed. So I probably won't try to do that.
Well, I'm asking about them this year. Did they feel that they were limited to the amount that they could spend?
I think they felt like amongst programs, they needed to allocate resources amongst programs, and then within programs, they had to figure out how to allocate resources to the people who applied or are going to be receiving funding in that program. So it's a multiple-step process. If you've seen the whole budget, you realize there's multiple programs and many entities receiving funding under each program, and it's a real balancing act that takes quite a bit of work to try to figure out how much to allocate where in order to accomplish. Again, their goal is to accomplish the initiatives identified in the strategic tourism plan, which was updated a couple years ago.
Right.
So they have a guiding document. They're trying to meet those various objectives.
And I apologize if my question wasn't clear. The pot of money that they started with, how did they determine that? Because essentially what Dan is saying is let's make that pot bigger to give it to them.
Right. They have a goal to maintain a certain amount of reserves so that, you know, if we hit a recession, which things have been growing great, but you don't want to end up allocating or committing funds that you then don't have because, you know, we depend on the money that's still coming in to pay for these things. So they've always tried to maintain a certain level of reserves, and that's kind of – they've actually decreased the amount of reserves over time because of the fact that the revenues are pretty steady, but they still are trying to do that. So they operate within a budget based on a projection of revenues, maintaining a certain level of reserves, and then allocate that. And then they, you know, they try to maintain that they have some fallback if they need it.
Thank you.
Peg, did you want to make a statement?
I think there are a couple of factors involved, and I think there's additional information that you may all not be aware of because you don't walk in our shoes all the time. So the fact that one thing that Ed mentioned is that many of these arts organizations apply for new tourism initiative grants. They apply for marketing grants. So while that ACOD line may appear to be decreased, they're actually receiving more funding from the overall tourism pot. The other thing is the Cuba Nature Center is rolled in. Their funding is actually rolled into the Museum of the Earth, PRI line. So while that may look like there's a dramatic drop there, it's actually included in that section. And then the third piece is that the Convention and Visitors Bureau has dedicated $40,000 out of our marketing budget specifically towards an arts marketing program, which has never been done before, and we're doing this in collaboration with these arts organizations that Dan has called out specifically, because we know that that's a unique differentiator for our county in the wintertime when we need more overnight visitation. So while it may appear that there is a decrease in funding, in essence, they're receiving more. The other piece that I just wanted to point out is reserves are there for a reason. The overall pot is literally based on a forecast. There's a number of formulas that go into that process, but things happen. Flooding happens. Emergencies domestically happen, and I don't like to bring things like the terrorist attack on September 11th. That didn't happen in this community. It happened to our country, but each community is impacted. And if we don't have a sufficient reserves, then we will start out behind the eight ball. You need to be able to have the resources there if you're in a situation. When it's a terrible situation, you don't stop marketing. You have to double your efforts to remind everybody that you're out there. So I understand it's very tempting to see that reserve account and say, oh, well, you know, $20,000 out of that won't make that big of a difference. But $20,000 could make a huge difference if we needed it in a really serious situation. So those are just a couple of comments I thought was important for you all to hear.
We'll go to Leslin. Leslin, I did have you on my list, but crossed you off before calling you. I apologize.
I had a smart comeback, but I'm going to save it.
We were just keeping your comments short.
And Dan, I appreciate what you're trying to do. And we had this conversation in committee meeting, as a matter of fact, a couple of times. And I too, do support the arts. After all, I'm involved with the arts. One of the things that I was going to point out about Cayuga Nature Center enrolling into PRI, so thank you for that. But one of the things that also got pointed out at the committee meeting is that there's still the potential of other organizations coming on board. These are not the only arts organizations that are within the county. So there's at least one more. There may be others that who will be looking for funding and so on. What I'd like to see us do in a case like this is that if we, I mean, the buck stops with us, no doubt. But if we are interested in sharing what our vision, our guidance, whatever it is that we'd like the STPB to be including in their plan to say, you know, our expectation is that each year your budget for arts organization is going to increase by 5% or 10% because new organizations come to board, prices are going up, et cetera, then we should do that and then allow them to do the due diligent deliberation they have been doing when they make these allocations, as opposed to doing something like this now. Because I'm looking at other organizations on this list that I'd like to see get more money, frankly. Not necessarily restore, but get more. So how do we balance that? So I would really prefer that we approach this from a place of offering guidance and suggestions on what we're looking for and allow for the process to happen as organically as has been happening with the STPB.
All right. Thank you, Leslie. I have Anna, Dooley, Peter, Jim, and then let's vote on the amendment.
I'm having one of those experiences where I've been holding so many questions I've forgotten a lot of them. But I had a few questions for Peggy, some of the things that I didn't understand that you were talking about. So I'm just curious, how what percentage of the annual budget do we keep in reserve, and how much money is currently in reserve?
Honestly, Anna, I can't answer those questions. Tom Knipe, who is the tourism director, he would be able to pull those numbers out of the air. I don't know if, Jim, if you want to.
Yeah, it came up the other day, and I think it was $75,000 in this budget. So if you were looking at a 25K hit to it, you would be down to 50.
Okay, that's helpful. And the second, you talked about emergencies. That was the big thing. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that this funding went to nonprofits to support the arts. Do we take money out of this fund to encourage, do marketing and encourage tourism directly?
Yes.
Okay.
And I don't want to take a lot of time. I know you've all been here and you're doing a lot of good work. The overall room tax collections, a portion of that goes to the county for administration. A portion of that, the way the ratio is set up for the room tax collections, 60% goes into marketing and 40% goes to new tourism product development. So within that marketing component, that includes the funding to the arts. It includes the funding to the Convention and Visitors Bureau operations. It includes funding for new tourism initiatives and marketing, event marketing grants. It goes to the community festivals. There's a number of things that all come out of that marketing pot. Mm-hmm. And then the new initiatives, there's strategic tourism implementation grants. There's a number of grants as far as new development as well.
So basically, I think we might need a remedial presentation. For some
absolutely.
Of us.
And I think that would be better done by Tom. He is the head of the overall program.
Thank you.
On the amendment, Dooley Kiefer.
Well, I second the Dan's amendment because on its face it made sense to me, and I guess it still does. If indeed the legislature had intended STPB to make all decisions for us, there would be no need for this to come back for us to act on it. But we have that responsibility to review what the recommendations are. I don't pretend to know the level of detail that Tom Knipp would know. And I think the addition of having someone like Tom in the planning department has been a very positive one for helping clarify and organize all the pieces of this program. Dan's motion to me seemed to say that the decision to not give these funds a couple of years ago made sense at the time to the STPB, but time has passed. Reserves have grown. They seem to be, that is, the income, which ordinarily would all go to reserves, it's the extra income. Reserves, we just heard, have been slightly decreased because the revenue stream seems so certain. And so now that the time has passed, I think it's fine for us as a legislature to say there is sufficient money available from reserves without penalizing the rest of the work plan for this year to give this handful of organizations what they hadn't gotten a couple of years ago. And so I still support Dan's motion.
Peter.
Yeah. You know, I feel bad about myself that I couldn't convince you all of this, that that was the right thing to vote for. So I'm going to tell you a couple of little, I'm sorry, I'm going to take a little bit more time than you'd think.
Please be brief.
I will be as brief as I can, Mike, but I want to make my point, okay?
Please be brief.
I will be as brief as I can.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me that. So I received a letter from a constituent of mine, a nasty letter telling me I don't belong on the legislature. I should get off the legislature because I don't care about ordinary people. All I care about is rich people like me. And the statement that it was is that I said at a meeting that we should give more money to a new opera company. That's what she was complaining about because she didn't think a new opera company was worth anything except to help my rich friends, okay? Made me very angry, that letter. I almost answered it, but thank God I didn't, okay? And I don't really understand how anyone can disagree with what I'm saying. I'm sorry. So here's what I'm going to say again. I think if we have a program that will, you know, there's an economic, an old economist who had a sentence and said, if you can find a program that doesn't hurt anybody and help somebody, then you're required to vote for it. I forget the name of that, but that's an important, it's a famous economic statement, okay? Now, I think if I said I want to have that money spent the way that you suggested over here, I would vote yes unless somebody raised his hand and said, no, you should vote no because we need one nurse that we don't have at the health department. And we need that more than I would vote against it, okay? But I can't think of such a statement. I've worked very hard because I'm trying to understand what you're saying, and I cannot find any. So I'm telling you, my love for the arts is not because I happen to like them. I can't stand hip-hop. But if somebody who has said he wants hip-hop, I'd vote for it. I don't care. I wouldn't listen. So I really would like to hear somebody say why what I'm saying is not true. Because I believe that what I'm saying will hurt nobody and will help somebody. So I think it's our obligation to do that.
Jim Dentz.
Thank you.
And then let's vote.
Thank you. Two things. It's my understanding, I think Tom said it here in the meeting the other day, that the 2018 budget for this is going to go back to the level of 2015. So that problem will be solved. The interesting comment that you made, Julie, is that let's put it in a sense that if we had a budget, we're talking about a budget here
in the planning department. And all of a sudden, our sales tax number go up in the middle of the year, and we say, well, we have all this extra money. Let's give it to the planning department. They would take it, of course, but when you do a budget, you count on a budget from beginning to end. You don't think there's going to be a gift in the middle. You hope that the next time you budget something, it will be good and you will end up with more money. But it makes no sense to me to think about just throwing money at somebody in the middle of the year, even though you think they might need it. It kind of defeats the whole purpose of why we have budgets and why people, you know, spend hours and days thinking about these things. So please vote against Dan's resolution and move on.
Dan wants another chance.
So I think it got said tonight, and it's been said a number of times before, is the reason that for some reason some people don't want to fund this is that the pie is not big enough. They said there's a pie, and it was cut into pieces, and now we have more pieces, and the pie is not big enough to give the same size slice to everyone. That was the only reason given for defunding these organizations. And so it is just, my whole point here is that the pie is much bigger than it was. And so if at this point we are not restoring the funding, then I haven't heard the reason yet why we are cutting the funding to these organizations. I will remind you that just in the last 3 months alone, we've taken in $125,000 more than the year before, which means that's five times the amount that I'm suggesting for this one expenditure. Okay, so the amounts of money are tiny. The entire hotel room tax is about $2.5 million. This is less than 1% of that. That's it. I'm done. Thanks.
Mike?
I'll be quick, Mike. I went to this thing this weekend, and we talked about how Republicans, Democrats get along and how just people in general get along. And a lot of it comes down to language. I mean, I keep hearing this referred to as cuts and how they're getting more money. It's just not coming out of this line.
They are not getting more money.
I just listened to
Mike
the woman
who's
in charge of the thing say that they're actually getting more money in the aggregate. They're just getting it from different places. So, I mean, we keep talking about it like this is a massive cut. I think if this was a massive cut, that this place would be packed with people from these organizations because they're really good at doing that. So that's what I'm looking at. Is
all right, I'm done with comments. We're voting on an amendment, and we're going to vote. The amendment that's been put forward by Dan is to change the allocation to the recipients to restore them to the 2015 level here. So all those in favor of the amendment, I'd like you to please raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All those opposed? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. That fails. We're back to the original motion. We're ready to vote. Is there further discussion?
What's the original motion?
We're back to the original motion, which is... Resolution M, approval of use of 2017 Arts and Cultural Organizational Development Professional Development Funds. That's out of budget. Are ready to vote? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Are there any opposed? That's unanimous. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I want to reiterate something that Jim said, and Tom, John Spence is here. All those are here in committee meeting, that it is our expectation. All of these organizations, they funded, remain the same from 2016 to 17. It is our understanding from what Tom Knipe said that funding will be increased in 2018. And for me, I want a record to show that that is the expectation I'm looking for, that this is what will happen. These organizations will all go up. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. Let's drop down and do resolutions to be added to or withdrawn from the agenda. Are there any tonight?
So this is the resolution B. Has that been added?
What are we talking about?
The acceptance of incentive award for electronic medical records. Did that get on?
That's on the agenda.
It's consent.
Oh, it's right there. We got it. We're good.
That's on consent. All right. Is there... is that coming forward?
History Center.
Was the...
Yeah.
The History Center name?
Pardon me?
Was the History Center name added?
Yes.
Would this be the time to...
No, I'm asking, this would be the time, if someone wanted to move to reconsider, this would be the proper time.
Me? I move to reconsider.
What? Reconsider what?
Peter Stein, this is a resolution that we had last time. Peter, you're moving to reconsider the naming of the Tompkins Trust Building as the Tompkins Center for History and Culture.
Yes, I am.
Is that correct? And let's see. Peter, you were not here last time. Is that right?
I believe.
Okay. So you have the right to ask that to be reconsidered. Is there a second for reconsidering this? Seconded by Anna. We will vote on whether or not to reconsider the motion. As you recall, it did not pass last time. On a 7-3 vote. All those in favor of reconsidering, please raise your hand. I think that's unanimous. All right. Therefore, we'll move to this resolution, which is on the table. And who wants to start the discussion on it? Rich, John.
Mike, I would ask.
Copies of it. We're going to send them out.
I would ask leave to have Rod Howe come forward.
Certainly.
To address the legislature.
Good evening.
Hello, Rod.
So you asked us to get some additional community input on the name. So we did ask the partners to send out the name Tompkins Center for History and Culture for some input. I don't know how many of the partners actually did. We created a survey link and also gave room for comments. So we weren't overwhelmed with responses. I think 42 people responded. And of those, 33 indicated support for the name. Here's just one example of a comment that was pretty typical. I think this is a great name. Having Tompkins in it lets people know it has a local flavor, and expanding the name to include history and culture welcomes and embraces everyone, even if they weren't crazy about history in school. There's a side note here as well. I don't know if any of you knew Everett Morse. Did anyone know Everett Morse? He's a descendant of the Morse chain family. He wanted to live to be 100, and he did, but he turned 100 on July 6th, and he died a couple days ago. So she just says, and a very happy birthday to Everett Morse in this comment. So we did get, we asked for feedback. We're still bringing back the name that we started with a week and a half ago, Tompkins Center for History and Culture. I did check with Iron Design. They're the ones that we're working with on branding and marketing. And certainly there is room for those who feel the name is not as exciting as it might be. There's room in the tagline, the monogram, the logo to do some additional material. So.
Let's talk to, Rich, you want to talk to us, please?
Yes, thank you. I obviously support the name. I think it does some heavy lifting. It identifies place. It indicates that it is a center for the various not-for-profits that are going to be located there and the visitors center. And also it indicates the purpose of history and culture. In preparation for the meeting, the one word in the name that is indicative of a place is Tompkins. And I did a little history check on Daniel Tompkins, because we all live here, but very few people know much about the guy. He was a person. That's where our name came from. He had been governor of New York State. He served 4 terms. He actually led the militia, if I can give you a few factual
things about Daniel Tompkins. In the War of 1812, he defended the state. And in keeping with a lot of the community values that we hold dear here, Daniel Tompkins opposed the death penalty at a time when the death penalty was pretty common. He condemned whipping and helped remove that as a penalty, a criminal penalty in the state for petty larceny. He laid the foundation for our public education system. He supported a state hospital for the mentally ill, which was a very progressive move at the time. And he pushed through the emancipation legislation in New York State to end slavery here. And finally, I'd note that he tried to deal fairly with the Indians. So he wasn't just a historical figure. He really helped shape who we are and what our values are as a state. And I think they reflect well on our county, which is something more about this name that I was surprised when I read all this, that there's something important there, I think. And it's a good name. I would also mention Daniel Tompkins died with real financial trouble, and he struggled with alcoholism. So it wasn't always good news, but he was a real, a person through and through. And he fought through his whole life for, I think, some positive values. I support the name.
Leslie.
So given everything that Fritz says, is it that we're naming it after Daniel Tompkins? I'm not sure I'm following where that is going.
Just the name came from, obviously, our county came from Daniel Tompkins. And
okay.
So I was led to research it. I thought it was really interesting information.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't want to call it the Daniel Tompkins Center for History and Culture. I wasn't
okay.
Floating that.
Okay, thank you. So I am curious about why the word county was taken out of the name. Like, I preferred a name to say Tompkins County Center for History and Culture, and I'm just wondering why. Because for me, Tompkins County says place, as opposed to just Tompkins, which is the name of an individual. And so I was just wondering why county, it was so cumbersome to have the word county in there, because I would support it with Tompkins County Center. That, for me, is a huge difference than just the name of an individual. Does anybody tell me why county was such a big deal and why it couldn't be in there?
Who wants to speak to that, Rod? Can you?
Well, at one point, I think when we brought to the Government Operations Committee, we actually were talking about the Center for History and Culture in Tompkins County, and I think there was some thought there that it was starting to be long and clunky. So out of that meeting, we said, well, maybe county doesn't need to be in the word, and it can be simpler and just Tompkins Center for History and Culture. So it came when we had the discussion at the Government Operations Committee.
Thank you.
Peter?
Were other people answering me?
Oh.
As I'm not done yet, Mr. Chair. I'm just
keep going then.
Were you answering me, Julie?
I was going to say something similar to that, but I think that it really moved me to shorten it and make it an easier statement. Rod called it longer and clunkier, and that's how it struck me. So
Tompkins County Center for History and Culture.
The extra word county makes it a little more awkward. And I recalled our airport is not the Ithaca Tompkins County Airport. It's the Ithaca Tompkins. We often
regional
use
airport.
Tompkins.
No, I understand that.
So that was good enough for me.
Thank you for that. And then, Rod, I'm really sorry to hear that you came back with a report that you don't know how many of the partners actually reached out to the community. That's very disappointing for me. I just want to make that known.
Are you done, Leslie?
I am done.
Thank you. Peter?
I was going to say something, but I withdrew it into myself.
Will?
So I will repeat something I said last time. Peter, thank you for bringing this back. I'm glad we are giving this another whack. We are doing something that's inherently, I think, not our forte as legislature, which is trying to figure something that will adequately represent a group that we will not be running, but a group that has formed to make really good use of a building that we are
helping to purchase. Ultimately, I think we should trust that group and know that they have done their best to come up with something that's going to work. When I first heard the name, it too struck me as kind of long and whatever, but Rod explained that this was basically the formal name, that there would be a logo, there was another word you used.
Monogram.
A monogram. And I remember, you know, our wonderful community college, whose new president we welcome today, is the Tompkins Cortland Community College. But for many years, it became known locally and was marketed as successfully as TC3. That became its identity. And I'm sure that you folks will figure out some good way to make this sort of sing. But I would hope we can trust this and move it forward tonight.
Jim?
I just did TCHC. You know, you take that's a cool sounding name. I was a little disappointed it wasn't the Mariana Center, but, you know.
Okay, are we ready to vote? We're back to the resolution that was moved for reconsideration, so it's on the table. The naming of the Tompkins County Trust building as the Tompkins Center for History and Culture. All those in favor, please raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Those opposed? That's 2. That passes. Congratulations.
Okay. Thank you very much.
We will take, let's take our break now. Let's take 10 minutes and come back. Let's go to reports. Chair's report, I have a couple of things I want to mention. We did have a flood in parts of the county a couple of days ago. There were people in Dryden who's had a foot of water in their first floor. Several apartments were and townhouses were hurt badly. Had some rot washouts. I know it was also problems in other parts of the county. It's not the first time we've had flash flooding. It won't be the last. Maybe worse with more unsettled air due to climate change. But we need to think about what we're doing. Fortunately, in Dryden, at least, flooding did not occur on Virgil Creek because of the flood control project that was put in there in 1997. It did hold the water back and did that. Most of the flooding took place on Egypt Creek, a very small creek that comes down from TC3 and other parts of the town, an area that's been studied, is being studied by the village for flood control issues, and the county has helped by providing some funding for that study. So I just wanted to mention that, and we are concerned about the people who got hurt. Talking with Lee Shurtleft, our Director of Emergency Response, they're waiting to hear from the State Emergency Management Office as to whether any of these recent flooding problems can be put together and ask for funding for not only municipal projects, but possibly for homeowners as well. Last week, we had a visit to Cornell University from Governor Andrew Cuomo. A number of us attended that at his invitation. We heard him speak, he and his Commissioner of Agriculture, Commissioner of, what was the other commissioner there, spoke about the idea of starting hemp production in New York, which had been discontinued by federal law many years ago because of the confusion of that agricultural product with marijuana plants. We were told that hemp has about 3% of the bad chemical in it compared to marijuana plants, which have 18% of the bad chemical in them. But that hemp can be used for over 25,000 products. We are currently importing hemp from Canada and Europe, and the idea is to develop eventually a large agricultural production and
manufacturing associated with it in New York State for hemp. Cornell University and Morrisville Tech have the licenses to import the seed, and they're doing the training, or doing the research on it, rather, for to develop the kinds of strains to do the different kinds of different products. Products from cosmetics to paper to food, a number of things were talked about at this meeting. So it was nice that the governor came and spoke about this in Tompkins County at Cornell University. After that, I attended a closed meeting of the Regional Economic Development Council, which had been moved from Binghamton to Cornell so that we could all attend the governor's presentation. While it was a closed meeting, it was to review the three cities that have submitted for the $10 million grants for downtown redevelopment. And those are the Village of Endicott, the City of Ithaca, and the Village of Watkins Glen. And the non-political people were allowed, although the political people were allowed to attend, people like me, as chair of the legislature, we were not allowed to vote. Only the economic development people and eventually the state will be voting on those. So we should hear eventually which of the three finalists received the $10 million. Remember, last year Ithaca had applied and did not receive it. We've started the administration search. We're starting the search for a committee for the administrator search. I hope to announce that committee at the next meeting. Dan, I've been working with Dan Klein, our vice chair. Any questions I can answer? Will.
More of a comment than a question, Mike. You referred, and thank you for the report on the meeting about hemp with the governor, and I'm glad that many of the different uses for this product are being highlighted and that the state is moving to reintroduce this. But I have to do take exception of the description of the bad chemical. I think you're referring to the THC component.
I didn't know the initials. I'm sorry.
Okay. And, you know, that even that certainly has a significant and legitimate place medically in terms of pain relief, nausea relief, but also recreationally. And many states are beginning to explore that can be a legitimate use. So while it is currently illegal and that this is not what the governor is proposing, I would challenge the description of it as inherently bad.
I will stand by my comment. Thank you, Will. Anything else on my report, Peter?
Yeah, the other day, forget that. Forget the background. Do you know the answer to this question? Is there any significant research that says that there is something addicting about hemp, the smoking hemp? Does anyone know the answer to that question? Is that an issue or not?
I think the way they explained it at the meeting was if you tried to smoke hemp, the amount you'd have to smoke to get high would be phenomenally high.
A month.
You have to smoke. You have to, and I realize that there in the past they've confused the word hemp with the marijuana plants. But as far as marijuana addiction, I don't have an answer for that.
Okay, but you know, I would like to know that it's trivial because that the danger of hemp is trivial, but I believe any addiction is dangerous. Okay, addiction to tobacco is dangerous, very dangerous. So I just wanted an answer to that question. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Mike, I think he mentioned something about you'd have to smoke 20 times as much or something to that effect.
A huge amount, yeah. I'll take the governor's word for it.
Cheech was very upset.
All right, let's go to other reports. Let's go to our county administrator, Joe Mariana.
Thanks, Mike. I just have a few items. All of them, I think, are just updates. First, I've been briefing you on the shared services study because it's coming your way. Panel will meet tomorrow night. The second public hearing will occur tomorrow night at the beginning of that meeting, which is at 5:30. A draft report has been prepared. It is in keeping with what we've talked about here. There's really no transformational shared service proposed. There are a number of smaller ones. I think the panel will approve it tomorrow night. I believe it will. And at that point, we will transmit the report over to GO for the legislature to begin looking at it. And again, it needs to come back to the panel in time for them to formally ratify it no later than September 15th. So that's on the way and moving along. Another thing that I've briefed the legislature on, I think consistently, is the Law Enforcement Shared Services Study. That study is also moving along. In fact, I think it's picking up speed now. The baseline report, which I've described in the past as very statistically heavy, a lot of information about costs and deployments and shifts and schedules and benefit plans and so forth, has been completed. It also includes the results of the survey that was done of almost 1,000 community people about their feelings on police services in their communities. With the baseline report, now will come the development of the options that we can look at, and they will range, as we've said from the outset, all the way from very small and simple to like shared training, all the way to the very complex like full mergers in a single countywide agency, and a number of options in between. And those are being identified now. I don't think anything is going to drift at all from what we have been talking about from the very start of this project. One item that will be in there is the idea of a co-location of the department, so it's not a merger. They would just occupy the same building. And in doing that, maybe there's some pollination of ideas and shared services and so forth within there. So except that there's been any variation from the list that we've talked about from the outset, that's probably the only small item that's a little bit different. This will soon move into a public arena. That toward the end of August, we think the weeks of August 21st and August 28th, there are three public presentations planned. This is a part of the scope of the consultant's contract, where the options will be presented along with benefits and costs to the community to get their input about those options, so that when the report comes to the governing bodies, which will happen sometime in the fall, late fall, you will have the benefit of knowing what the public has said in these input sessions about each of these options. And it all concludes late this year when the matrix of options is presented to the governing bodies, and they can decide, do we want to do any of these or do we want to do none of these? So that will be a decision point, again, that will come late this year. So that's the track that study is currently on.
You mentioned co-location. I assume that just means the city and the county?
Yeah, it does.
And which are the police agencies that are not participating?
Only one, Trumansburg.
And would you care to share which police agency got really high marks from its residents?
On the results that I saw, Cayuga Heights is beloved by its residents.
Thank you.
Yes. Really quickly through two other items, the job searches, the two positions that are currently open. The DSS search committee met today. Interviews are going to be beginning at the very beginning of August. So that process is moving right along. Again, the first round of interviews will occur in early August.
Can people still apply to that or not?
For DSS, if you're interested, we can. No, that posting is closed, so that one's over. The one that's still open is planning. So the planning posting will continue to be open until August 4th, and then we'll begin to talk about the interview process for that one as well. I think I said to the legislature the last time that my plan is to make Kit Kephart, who's the deputy commissioner of DSS, the interim commissioner. Patricia's leaving at the end of this month. So the idea would be to raise Kit to the interim position and let her occupy that until a permanent commissioner is found. Hopefully that won't be a very long period of time. Biggs, we talked about the neighborhood meeting for the at the Biggs parcel at the last meeting. That's still scheduled for tomorrow evening at 7:30. It's either 7 or 7:30 at PRI. And Ed and Katie will be there to present some ideas, concepts to the neighborhood about that parcel.
7:30.
Great, thank you. And the last thing in my notes, I think all of you have it. Patricia Carey is only here until the end of this month, and there is a reception for her on Thursday between 3 and 5. It bumps pretty close to some committee meetings that are critical, but there will be a reception for her. She doesn't want parties and things like that, but she's a person who has made a tremendous contribution to this county. And I hope we all have a chance. If we can't go to the reception, again, she's not great about accolades, but a note, a call, whatever, I'm sure would be appreciated and certainly deserved. She is, I said in committee the other day, there is no more complex department or important department than DSS, and she has done an excellent job for a long time in running that department and providing crucial services and doing it in a very fiscally responsible way. So I will miss her greatly. I know you will, too, and I hope you all have a chance to say goodbye to her before she leaves at the end of this month. So that's my report.
Where is that reception?
Over at the Human Services Building.
Okay. Let's go to Jonathan Wood, our county attorney.
I just want to make two relatively quick points. I wanted to make a comment about an article which appeared in the Ithaca Voice this week. I'll read the headline. The headline says, Tompkins County Sheriff's Deputy Accused of Criminal Misconduct, Filing False Reports. And then after it was off the front page, there was a follow-up update. Tompkins County Deputy Accused of Criminal Misconduct, Despite Court Decision Finding Him Credible. I'm very familiar with this case. The accusation that he engaged in some misconduct was made by a lawyer who's representing a defendant in a criminal case. There is, in my view, no basis for it whatsoever. In my view, the deputy was entirely truthful. That's my one thing. The other thing I have to say is I had the occasion to meet the new Cornell University counsel, Madeline Wessel, who came by to say hi to me and Joe, and she certainly makes a very good first impression, and I think it'll be a good thing for Cornell. That's my report.
Questions? Mike.
Would it be prudent for us to, like, put a response out when something like that happens?
Well, both Marcia and I did contact the newspaper, and after several days, they did print a revised article, which was much more, let's say, much fairer than the first one. The obvious problem is that the first thing was out there for a while, and frankly, it just was not accurate.
Thank you, Jonathan. Let's go to Rick Snyder, our Director of Finance.
Thank you, Mike. I have two topics to discuss tonight. One is going to be short and sweet, and that's sales tax. The second will be a review of the financial report, which you received by email a week ago, and I also distributed hard copies of the five documents at your desk before the meeting started tonight. And we're not going to read all those five documents, but I did want you to have them at least a week ahead of time, and that's why I sent out the email. I presented for you a four-page summary that was on top of your documents. It starts with financial report for July 18th. I hope you find that on your stack of papers there. And inside your red folder is the actual sales tax reports that we've prepared for tonight's discussion. So if you would look at that summary and grab those sales tax distribution summaries, I'll quickly go over them for the sales tax portion. I'd like to report that for June, the county was up 8.46% compared to last June. compared to last year. This is the second biggest June that we have on record. And if you look on that same June sales tax distribution summary, if you move over and look at the year-to-date contributions towards the right, you can see that the county's portion for sales tax was $16,752,268 compared to $15,719,915 in 2016. This represents an increase of $1,032,353 increase year over year, or 6.57%. So that's a pretty healthy increase looking at year-to-date figures. We're exactly halfway through the year at 50% through the year. There is a second report that looks just like the other one that has quarter at the top, second quarter. And in this report, we look at the same information, but on the second quarter 2016 compared to second quarter 2017, if you move down towards line 6 and 7, the county portion, which we always focus on, you can see we're looking at about a 3.33% increase just comparing the second quarter of this year to the second quarter of last year. This also represents the very biggest second quarter that we have on file. So this was a really good turnaround for our sales tax, which we were worried about during the first 3 or 4 months of this year. So the second quarter came out to be our biggest quarter on record. And we should probably have about one more month under our belt when we get the month of July, which it will be in mid-August. That'll probably be the last figures that we can supply to Joe as he refines figures that's in his budget for next year. The very last sales tax report you only get on a quarterly basis, and that's the one that shows all the years from 1997 right up through 2017. And in that particular one, you can see how these really good quarters stand out compared to the last couple of years. Once again, the total year to date is $6.3 million out of a budget of the county portion, $16,752,000 compared to a budget of $33,432. So we're right at 50%. Do I have any questions on the sales tax information?
Questions?
We'll move right into the financial statement report. I've tried to provide everything that was asked for in previous years, and so my notes get a little bit longer from year to year because I keep trying to bring the same information that legislators have asked for in the past. In the email that I sent out 1 week ago, you got five documents. Two of them were simply required letters from the auditors, and one of them was our state report, which simply shows the amount of state funding that we get from them. And there's an executive summary, which I really like a lot, and I always bring your attention to that because not only does it give a brief narrative on the most important information, but it shows it spread over many, many years. So you can see, in some cases, 5 years of data, 6 years of data, and I think that's most helpful if you want to look at particular funds, like the Capital Projects Fund or the Transportation Fund, which is our airport fund, or the General Fund. And so that information has also been presented in hard copy to you tonight. Should you like to take it along with you, feel free. If you don't want to take it with you, just leave it on your desk, and I'll take them back to the office with me. But the financial report, which is the biggest booklet or the biggest document, has been reviewed thoroughly by the Audit Committee, and the Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee received a briefer presentation from the auditors. That was just a couple weeks ago. We don't do a formal presentation of the actual document tonight, but these three or four pages I'm going to use as my notes tonight to present what I think are the highlights of the report. And once again, you could look at the executive summary and the management discussion analysis, which I've recommended for you to read in the actual financial report document. These documents are always made available on our website, and they've been given for legal purposes to the legislative clerk for filing here. Now, as we get down to this on the first page of my notes where it says highlights of the financial report, from those two letters that the auditors submit, I'll just give you the main requirements for why those letters are necessary. In the first letter, it basically says that there's no management comments, but we do get one. That's the management letter, and we do get one management comment that recurs every year, and that's just a comment that we can't seem to make go away. It has to do with CHIPS funding and the way that the state requires us to bid that, but we don't bid that here. We do that with our own local crews, most of the work, and there's not a way that we can budget for that properly to fit the state requirement. And most counties get this exact same note or measurement comment, and haven't found a way to make it go away. So it's the one and only management comment that comes back, and it just comes back to haunt us every year. We haven't found a solution to satisfying that. The other letter that you get is a communication letter, and that addresses some other issues that the auditors need to present to you for legal purposes. But there's a third letter, one of the most important ones, is found inside the financial report. In fact, it's on page one of the actual financial report. It's called the Independent Auditor's Report. And that's where it shows that we receive an unqualified opinion on the basic financial statements. It's also an unqualified opinion on the expenditures, the schedule of expenditures of federal awards. That schedule of expenditures for federal awards are in the last few pages of the large financial report. That lists all your federal funding. So if you're looking for one easy-to-find place that lists all our federal dollars, it's on the last five or six pages of that big book that shows exhaustively each and every type of federal fund that we receive. So that's at the end of the financial report. There's another letter called the Independent Auditor's Report on Internal Control over Financial Reporting and on Compliance and Other Matters, based on an audit of the financial statements performed in accordance with government auditing standards. That's page 78 of the financial report. That report says there's no material instances of noncompliance, and there are no material internal control weaknesses at the financial statement letter. So those are two very important comments that shows how well we're doing, and that there's nothing that the auditors can bring to your attention that would signify noncompliance or lack of controls. If you review those federal funds, that's listed at the back of the book. There's five or six pages. And I know federal awards and federal dollars has come up a lot in the news lately on whether you're going to continue to receive the same amount of federal dollars. But if you add up all the federal award programs, that comes to $33,620,903. So the auditors thought that's important for you to know. That's part of the document at the end, which is called the single audit. If you ever wonder, what is that when people make reference? Do you have a single audit? What is a single audit? A single audit is when you have large federal programs and you have to conduct a separate audit that called the single audit that looks just at the federal programs, the federal grants, and the programs that utilize these grants. That's the single audit. So now I'm up to number four, bullet point number four on the second page. And it's important for you to know that our undesignated or unassigned fund balance for the general fund in 2016 went up $5,630,000. It's $5.5 million. I wrote there right underneath it how much it went up in previous years. such as in 2015, that same unassigned fund balance went up $5,463,000. In 2014, it went up $4,444,000, and in 2013, it went up $1,461,000. So those are all healthy signs of our unassigned fund balance that's not programmed or reserved for any other purpose, how much that has gone up in each of the last four fiscal years. Now, you know we have a policy that says we need to maintain a certain minimum fund balance. By policy here, you as a legislature have told us that we want to maintain a minimum fund balance of 10%. I recorded here in this bullet point for the last 4 years of what our percentage is of general fund balance compared to budgeted revenues. For the year just ended, 2016, that percentage is now 22%. In 2015, it's 18.6%. 2014, 15.2%, and in 2013, 12.8%. The next paragraph, I wanted to bring to you some recommended policies and some recommended literature, of which our auditors have already opined on. And I've written there that in the GASB literature, it recommends 15 to 20%. As a recommended fund balance. That's the same number, the same percentage that our auditors from INSERO recommended to the Audit Committee and the Budget Committee just a couple weeks ago. They confirmed that that is what they also tell their clients, between 15 and 20%. GFOA, which is the Government Finance Officers Association, recommends no less than 2 months of, which is 16.7%, right in the same ballpark there. A regular general fund operating revenues or regular general fund operating expenditures. You can write your policy either way. You can compare it either to revenues or you compare it to expenditures. Yes, Annie, you had a question?
I just wanted to go back to the paragraph or the section where you were talking about the unassigned fund balance, and we're now at 22%. I remember we had a robust conversation about this last year, about it getting to a point where it's maybe too much. And we were at 18. We were having a discussion about 18 maybe being the top end of where we wanted to be, because then it becomes a conversation of how much taxes we need to be collecting. So I wanted to get yours and Joe's input on that, what the interest might be of what we would do with this money. I guess I'm going to stop there.
Yeah, I'll let Joe describe what, as I shared with this information early with him, is that we want to caution the legislature in knowing that even though it shows up here as unassigned, we've made certain decisions as a legislature and at management, that number is kind of artificially high at this point. For instance, in some of the work that we've done in sharpening our pencil, if we take that same unassigned fund balance and we just remove from that the reserves that are going to be applied to the current year that we're using in 2017, and we take out the Tompkins Trust building that we're paying $2 million cash, that brings the reserve level down to 20%.
Okay.
So just that one transaction and what we've used for this year's budget brings us right back down from 22 to 20. Then if you look at next year's 2018 budget that we're crafting right now, the use of one-time OTRs at this point is looking close to be in the $2 million range. So there's another $2 million chunk that you as a legislature will be looking at later this fall in programming for use in the next budget cycle, 2018.
Which would bring us down to 18%.
And that brings us right back down to 18%.
Okay.
So a lot of these things, they're a snapshot in time. So when I'm reporting to you, this is where it was at December 31st, 2016, but we're making decisions every day, such as use of reserves for building purchases and possibly other capital purchases. I would like to be able to see in the future, just my own concerns, is that we move more towards building, taking some more money and using it for capital projects so we have less reliance on debt for everything. We've been able to do that recently by being able to fund the local share of many capital projects by just using general fund transfers or sometimes transfers from the D fund, the highway fund, to fund our portion of big projects.
Peter Stein without holding a question.
I'm sorry. Peter, you had a question?
Yeah, I had not a question, but a statement. Okay.
Here's your microphone, Peter.
I find it rather difficult for me to follow everything you're saying. It goes very fast, and I can't. And I only heard one thing that concerned me, okay? There was a word unqualified that was repeated several times, and I wondered what it meant, okay? That was the only thing that disturbed me.
That's accounting jargon that auditors use. That's the highest level of opinion that you can get from an audit. So when it says it's unqualified, that means they didn't find anything that they would take issue with.
Okay, thank you very much. That relieves
That's
me.
Pretty much the highest level
okay.
of
it
audit.
It doesn't sound like it.
Jim's also got his hand up.
Yeah, Anna asked a question to both Joe and Rick, and I didn't hear Joe's response because he didn't make one on her question, so I would hope that he might.
Same as Rick's. I think it's important for the legislature to know that some of this money is already spent. So it's not conjecture about how it might be spent. We spent $2 million to buy the Tompkins Trust building. We have put $1.5 million, almost $1.6 million. You did it last fall. You spent reserves at that time to balance the 2017 budget. We used it for one-time money. So that money is already spent. So $3.5 million, almost $3.6 million, of the amount that you're looking at, it's already gone.
So the 1.6 you're saying that we spent to balance last was the OTRs?
Yeah, those were the one-time OTRs, which then are deducts from this fund balance.
The reason, part of why I was asking, and then you can finish, is because, you know, given the jail study report that just came out, it's going to require that we look at some programs and some support, and I suspect it'll have a hit on this independent of the OTRs that we're expecting. So I'm glad that it is as robust as it is, but that was the impetus for, you know, is this as robust as I'm thinking, and is there wiggle room, because we're going to be discussing a lot.
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
Rick, how are we doing with your report?
We're about halfway now. We're on the second page, and I'm down to the operating results of the general fund. This is where we compare the revenues and the expenditures on the second page of the summary, and I'll just go over 2016 for the general fund. The revenues were $156,558,000 compared to expenditures of $154,050,000, which shows revenues over expenses in the amount of $2.5 million. So that's how well we did in the general fund, even though we were in 2016. And then I've given the next 3 years immediately under that, 15, 14, and 13, so you can see how that compares. So that pretty much wraps up the very positive and good news of the general fund. We're down to bullet point five, in which I'm going to discuss the transportation fund. And as you can see in my notes, that the transportation fund is what the auditors call it, but our familiar notion here is that it's the airport fund. In our airport fund, we had a positive, very good news, a positive assigned fund balance of $19,430. That doesn't sound like a very big number to have $19,000 as a fund balance, but this compares favorably to the 2015 deficit unassigned fund balance of a minus $179,000. And the year before that, 2014, we had a deficit minus $337,000. So we've had a couple of years, quite a few years in a row, where we had negative fund balance at the airport or transportation fund.
Well done, Mike.
The first year since I've been here that we have broken into the black, so to speak, as far as having a positive fund balance. And let me just finish this part on the airport, and then we'll take questions on it, because the next part is on the revenues. The gain for the airport in 2016 was $196,559. The net operating gain for fiscal year 2015, the year before, was $145,891. And then there were a lot of net operating losses in the years before that. I've supplied a table there that shows the increase in revenues over the last 7 years and the expenditures, even though they haven't gone up. They've kind of gone up some years. They've gone down other years. They haven't gone up as much as the revenues have gone up. But the net gain or loss in the right-hand column, and if I would go back earlier than this to 2009 and 8, you would see even more negative numbers. So we've had negative or losses in 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014. And finally in 15 and 16, we're showing revenues exceeding our expenditures in the last 2 years. That's very good news. And overall, the transportation fund revenues increased by 8.9% this past year, and the expenditures increased only 7.6%. So, Anna.
I was curious to confirm, when did Mike Hall come back on board?
A couple years.
2015, maybe 2014. I find that interesting. I know he's doing a really good job. And the other question I had was the airline, the additional airline that we just. When did that? If there's an additional airline that came into the airport, am I making something up? That came back in. That was in the last.
We have Delta, United, American. We've had.
That was in the last like 4 years, 3 years.
Well, they're flying larger planes. They're flying jets now. So that's been the large change in service there.
And that's in the last 2 years, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. That's just another thing that I wanted to point out that probably had a big influence on this.
Peter.
I have just one question. Everything sounded good to me except one thing, was that we have had these negative numbers told for many, many years, okay? I don't remember that. But were they announced at this meeting, those negative numbers, and we decided on ourselves that that was the right thing to do? Is that correct? I just wanted to know the answer to that question.
I've been making the reports as long as I've been here. I know that there was no formal presentation of the financial report prior to my coming here. This is the first time that the legislature actually gets the report and is asked to accept the report. And that was something new that I've implemented since I've been here. No, I don't think that there has been a lot of projection of the bad news at the airport, at least during the first year or so that I was here. This goes back to 2013, because there really wasn't an explanation on how we were going to heal it and make it better. And I think that there's been a lot of things that have happened the last couple of years that have really put us on a better track. Of course, one of the things is what you've lent to the airport, too, and is that you've done away with your administrative fee for, is this the third year now, or is it one more year to go in 2018?
Third year.
So for 3 years, you have waived the administrative fee, which is like $126,000 for the last 3 years, and that with numbers this close to breaking even, that there in itself could be the reason for why they're doing as well as they are. Another thing that's never been done before, and I was just made aware of it about 19 months ago, was that we've never had a PFC audit. Do you know what PFCs are?
Private first class.
Private.
What?
I have one of those in my family.
Tell me what it means.
Passenger facility charge.
Thank you.
Now, that's a certain additional fee that's added to everybody's ticket that flies in and out of any airport, including our Ithaca airport. And that passenger facility charge is supposed to be collected by every airline, and it's only like $3.50 or $4.50, depending on what you're flying on. And that's supposed to be sent in to you by every single airline that comes in and out of your airport. So we collect these fees and we put them in a separate fund, and you're only allowed to use these passenger facility charges or PFCs for FAA-approved projects. And when I say FAA-approved, they approve every jot and tittle, every line item on what it is that you're recommending that you buy. So when you're doing a capital improvement at the airport, whether it's runways or something to the terminal or T-hangers or any of that, jet bridge, they will stamp approved or unapproved if you want to use your PFCs to pay for that. Well, we've been accumulating PFCs in the bank. We get them every month, every year. I believe it's about $300,000 a year. So they accumulate, and they accumulate. And you get to use them for some of the capital projects. When you see these resolutions that Mike brings forward to us where it's going to be X million dollars, but don't worry about it because 95% of it's going to pay by the Fed or the state. All that we have to pay is the remainder, which is usually 5%. And then it's usually written in a resolution, but even that's not going to come out of your local funding, whether it's the general fund or the airport operating fund. It's coming out of PFCs. So you've seen that a lot in most of the resolutions.
Dooley had her hand up.
Okay.
We really need to get through the rest of this report. Go ahead.
Yes, my hand was up just to point out the fact that we have forgiven the airport what they used to pay us, which has helped to make it look so positive on it.
Okay. Jim?
No, I want to roll on.
All right. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll try to wrap it up with the airport, and then I'll just have some conclusions. The airport PFC, as good a program as it is, has never been audited. And we were told 19 months ago from the FAA that, where's your PFC audit? And I said, what is that? And I asked staff, what is that? And nobody had ever heard of it. I asked our auditors, and they had never done one. And so I had to get information from the FAA on what it is that we were supposed to audit, because it's a pretty simple function. You get the money in, and you put it in a separate trust account, and it sits there. And then you use it for just these specified projects, as I've told you about. So it's not really, you know, rocket science. So they sent us some copies of what a PFC audit is supposed to look like. So we sat down and had a think tank meeting with engineers and airport staff, my staff, and the auditors to come up with what we thought was a good audit program that would satisfy the FAA. We have been working on that audit for 19 months because it's very complicated, not the issue, but because since there was never one done before, we have to go back to 1906. No, we have to go back to 1998 and trace every project that was funded with PFCs. We also had to tie out our revenues that we show on our books with what the FAA had reported to them as revenues. We had to tie out our expenditures for what was FAA approved on our books with what they were showing on their system for 19 years. And so we've been working on it for 19 months. And I'm here to tell you that we're at the draft report stage that was shared last week. And then when we got the draft report, we shared it with management staff at the airport. We shared it with engineers. Now nobody agrees with those numbers. So now we have to go back and find out to get everybody on the same page to agree with the audit. It's been a long go, but we are first to tell the FAA right out of the chute that this is our first audit, and we have found some things. We found examples where the FAA revenues on their system don't agree with what we shared with them for that particular year. And within 19 years of data, there's been some years where there were big differences, and other years they tied right out perfectly. So I'll be glad to get this one done, and we've never done a PFC audit before, but I know Joe and Mike want to sit down and discuss this. I've been putting it off until we get the final version of the audit done. I think it'll happen in the next 3 or 4 days, really, until we get the final audit. So that's an important piece of the puzzle, is to have our PFCs audited for the first time. Now, my last discussion point is on countywide figures when you look in the financial report, you get to those GASB reports right in the very beginning where they roll everything up. They roll all the funds, general fund, transportation fund, capital projects, all kinds of every fund. They roll everything up. Well, why do they do that? Because that isn't really helpful for us as managers. Well, they want to be able to show what the county's net position is as a whole, as a universe, as if you could look at the county as one big thing. And so when they do that, the county's net position for 2016 actually decreased $2,413,000. And in contrast, that net position, the county's net worth, so to speak, increased by about $10.8 million the year before in 2015. Most of that is due to things that we don't have control over. There's a thing called OPEB, which is post-retirement benefits, and they can go up by many millions in just 1 year. Now, we don't book that in any particular fund of the county, but it does get included in this GASB schedule in the beginning where you have to put a number on what your post-retirement benefits are. And you know what that is when you have retirees that retire and we keep paying half of the retirement of their health insurance forever, that's a big number. And we assign an actuary to give us what the growth of that number is each year. And that number keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger each year, that liability. And so that's why your net equity is shrinking. The other second thing that makes that net equity go down is retirement benefits. Just like retirees' health insurance benefits, our overall retirement benefits when people leave employment, that, you know, they're not actually on the payroll anymore, but the state retirement system is paying that benefit. Well, now with the new accounting rules, I think you'll find in the footnotes, that footnote is about 7 pages long, just the footnote, that explains what our pension retirement portion is of the state system. So they go through all those schedules, the auditors, to find out what is your allocable portion, the county's portion of the total retirement system. And that benefit can move. And it usually moves higher each and every year. And that's why the net equity has gone down. And so the last section I have on number 8 here, on the very last page, is a question that has come up maybe 2 or 3 years ago. Somebody asked, what's our constitutional debt limit and how close are we? I wrote this first paragraph that says, the county's total long-term debt obligations and other long-term liabilities amounted to $135,338,000. That's all our long-term debt. At December 31st, 2016, the county had $53,915,000 in bonded indebtedness. Now, what is bonded indebtedness? That's all our bonds. That includes our long-term bonds and our bands, but it doesn't include the TTASC bonds, the Tobacco Asset Securitization Corporation. And it also, that number also includes $1.2 million in installment purchase debt that represents a combined total of $55,192,000. Of that amount, $55,192,000 was subject to the constitutional debt limit, and it represents 11.62% of the county's total statutory debt limit. So if anybody wants to know or is asking, where are we on how much could we borrow within that statutory limit, we're at a very low 11.62%. It's very good. The next three paragraphs just compare where we were the last 3 years. The year before, we were at 11.31%. The year before, we were at 12%. The year before that, we were at 10%. So between 10 and 12% is where we fluctuate. That's where we're at. And that's all I really have. I have some other notes in there that you can read. You can take these documents along home with you. But I tried to give you the highlights and the most important, what I feel are the most serious points for discussion purposes tonight.
All right, let's take a few questions, but we really have got a lot more of agenda to do. Rich, then Dave.
Rick, I wanted to start out by commending you for getting through this audit. This is a remarkable report from Incero in terms of not raising issues. As I said at the break, it's a stunningly dull auditing letter, and that is a great compliment. I'm curious, given that we have really healthy fund balance, we're nowhere near our debt limit, but we yet aren't at the best bond rating. And I'm wondering, does this have any impact? Can we improve our bond rating when we get an audit report like this?
The quick answer is no. We really can't, because we go every year, Joe and I prepare a lengthy presentation for them. And if we would go from to at least 25% in reserve, you might be able to get the highest rating in the land. We were at the second rating. That first rating, there's no county in New York that has that rating. So we're amongst the three or four other counties that are good enough to have the second highest rating. But there are no counties that have that highest rating. So if we would have a 25% fund balance, and if we could get our population numbers to move and our per capita income to move and some other demographic factors that, quite frankly, we don't have any control over, if we could somehow get those things to move, we might be able to get a better bond rating. But we've done pretty much, I have to commend Joe on helping us put these presentations together each year, because we try to put our best foot forward and show them how positive. I mean, you're a legislature that, quite frankly, you haven't been shy about increasing taxes when you felt there was a need to increase tax. Moody's likes that. You know, Moody's likes that a county has, you know, many different revenue sources and not just one that they're stuck with. You know, so we're doing the things that you need to do to be able to attract really good, you know, credit rating and really good interest rates.
Dave,
I hope that satisfies your
Dave, comment. And then Jim, and then let's move on.
Eric, as far as the PFCs go, what happens if we end up on the wrong end of that? Where does the money come from? Does it come out of our fund balance, or does it come out of the airport fund, or how does that work?
Well, there really isn't an airport fund balance. You see how narrow that is to, I mean, in the past it's been negative. So there really isn't, for all intents and purposes, a fund balance. The way the audit is shaking out right now, it looks like there have been some overfunding to the debt service fund, which means we can get money back out of the debt service fund and maybe put back towards the airport. So I don't see it being a big deal for the airport, as if they would have to pay more money out. I think the reallocation of these funds will be more towards some capital project funds that are part of the airport. And so I'll give you a complete report on who owes who. Once we end up moving the monies, I think we're going to end up on the good side of it as far as having enough PFCs to pay for everything that we were supposed to. But I think it's mostly going to be good news, and I don't think it's going to be a disadvantage for the airport fund at this point.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Jim.
Yeah, a couple things. I have a son-in-law who worked for Moody's, and he's a player in that field. And Tompkins County, there is no AAA rating, frankly, in New York State. And we are at the best possible rating we can have. And what I thought interesting in Rick's report, our constitutional debt limit is 10, 11, 12%. Our friends at Cortland are banging 100 over there.
So. Okay.
Could I ask a question?
Thank you for... Oh, I'm sorry, Dooley.
This was not part of what you presented, but at another point in time, we talked about the need to depreciate what we own, physical facilities. Does that come under your bailiwick at all?
Well, we do.
But it's not part of this.
Yes. It's in the GASB statements in the front, even though we might not show depreciation in the fund types like general fund or the highway fund, there is a depreciation figure that's shown in the GASB statements in the front. And there are comments and footnotes about what our depreciation is under the fixed asset section It talks about, here's depreciation expense in note 7. It's on page 34 and 35.
Thank you.
She's referring to our capital assets.
Thank you.
And how that depreciation is allocated.
Rick, thank you very much for this interesting report and a good lesson. We're going to have a test after this, and we're all going to get a certain number of education credits for having listened to this.
CPE.
Thank you.
Continue.
Jim?
Mike, do you want to do the acceptance of the audit now or wait till later?
Yeah, why don't we? Let's get it out of the way. You want to move it?
Yeah, I will do that. Acceptance of audited financial report for the fiscal year ended 12/31/2016. I would move that.
That's Resolution N-7139. Seconded by Glenn. Discussion.
Let me just say one thing. Mike Sigler and I were at the meeting before the Budget Committee last week for an hour or so with Insero people and heard the more specialized report, although Rick's was pretty specialized tonight, but we heard it out of the mouth of the people who actually did it. So I will put that out there.
Thank you. Ready to vote? Those in favor, please raise your hand. Any opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you, Rick.
Mike, I just want to announce that after this week, two more weeks, I'm going to be out of the office on vacation for just 1 week from July 31st to August 4th. And I just want to give you a heads up if you're looking for me at your next meeting and you find the seat empty. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rick. Pretty extensive report.
Can you send PSC to substitute?
Yeah.
All right, let's go to our consent agenda.
We thought we were all going to get out of here at 8:30.
We have one advisory board appointment to the government operations committee to the Greater Tompkins County Municipal Health Insurance Consortium Board of Directors as an alternate, Steve Estes.
Sounds good.
We have some resolutions. If you want them off, just say so. Resolution A, this is out of Health and Human Services Committee, authorization to execute a 3-year contract, administration and provision of transportation for early intervention and preschool special education children residing in Tompkins County Health Department. Resolution B, acceptance of incentive award for electronic medical records project for the Tompkins County Mental Health Department. That's ID 7161. Out of facilities and infrastructure, Resolution C, authorization to accept a Climate Smart Communities grant from New York State Department of Environmental Conservation for construction of a food scraps tipping area at the Recycling and Solid Waste Center, ID 7147. And D is audit of final payment, Booley Associates, Inc., Tompkins County Public Library, 21st Century Renovations Phase 1 Project, ID 7153. Is there a motion on the consent agenda? Rich, seconded by Peter. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Any opposed? That's unanimous. Okay, let's go to standing committees. Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Leslie McBean Claiborne is the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee will meet next Wednesday, 3:30, Old Jail Conference Room.
Questions? Old Library Committee, we're searching for a date for the committee meeting, which will be like the first or second week in August. Questions? Anna?
Has that gone through the city and it's back to you and it's now active at the county level? Is that why you're meeting?
That's correct. Public, Julie. Yeah.
When the old library committee meets, will there be an updated presentation of what is actually going to be built? Because we had a report before the city had officially finished acting.
We're inviting the developers to come, and we want to make sure that they're available for that meeting, yes. I expect that they will. They'll be there to ask about that.
Thank you.
Public Safety Committee, Rich John is the chair.
Thank you, Mike. The Public Safety Committee will be meeting this Thursday at 3:30. We have a full agenda. We're going to have a report from Healthy Youth. The county administrator is going to be bringing a resolution for a mass notification system. We have a report from the Stop DWI Advisory Board. And the Department of Emergency Response will be bringing forward the resolution to have the surcharge on the contract cell phones so that they can contribute to 911 services. Assigned counsel will be giving a report, and we will have our sheriff's office and jail report. So 3:30, it should be a busy agenda.
Questions? Thank you, Rich. Let's go to Health and Human Services Committee. Hannah Callis is the chair.
We met this Monday. We had the second of the series for the housing reports from all of the departments. This one did not have a video recording, but we do have an audio recording. It was a great report by Patricia. It was her last report to the Health and Human Services Committee, and specifically talking about temporary assistance as it is related to housing. So in relatively quick summary, the services within the DSS department that do support housing initially as temporary assistance, and as all of you guys know from Joe's reports, when he does the budget series, temporary assistance is for the first 5 years. That is primarily funded from federal funding, and then it switches to the safety net, and that is partially paid for by the county, and that's both of those are administered through DSS. And that is housing support for people who qualify. Another service that they provide is housing support through emergency services. And this is, for example, support through the rescue mission in winter. That's hotel support for those who are homeless. The next one that she spoke about was special services, and that includes adult protective services, where they work with mental health, and that is where individuals who receive, for example, this was an example she gave, individuals who receive Social Security but can't necessarily do the administration of handling the checks that come in and making sure that it gets to paying for their rent, paying for their food, paying for all the other needs that they have. There are cases in which the DSS can become a representative payee to protect them from people who are trying to take that funding from them, which does happen. They are currently a payee for about 90 of 211 people who are currently receiving special services under the adult protective services. One of the things that I did ask of her was that we get a summary list of all of the services because they provide so much support with respect to housing that it is probably difficult for clients to know where to begin, what support they can find with them, whether they can find support, and it turns out there is a summary list of all the services with respect to housing that is provided to people who are about to leave the jail so that they know what support they can receive, and I've asked her to give us a copy of that. I think that that's something that we should certainly provide to any of our listservs, make that available far and wide throughout our community, because the whole point of the series that I'm working with the departments, that we as a committee are working with the departments, is to help the community understand what support and services we provide. So to have that type of material that we can share with the whole community, I think, is exceptionally valuable. The last thing I would say about it, I know that MRC has a simulation that they do walk people through the experience that people would have leaving the jail and coming back into the community, and trying to seek services from the umpteen number of different options that they have. So just within DSS, having this many can be very confusing. So this was helpful, and it will be audio recorded so that people have a sense of it. The last thing I would say, obviously, she reminded us that 211 is the place that people can call to really get an in to all of these. So I wanted to thank Patricia publicly on video for giving us such an amazing summary report, and we wished her well. And that's the end of my report.
Thank you. Questions? Dooley?
I didn't completely understand Resolution B, which was on consent. I didn't take it off. I didn't want to vote against it. But could you explain to me what's going on with that?
Yes. So the Care Compass has funding that they allocate out to counties in order to help create electronic systems for all of their records, for all of their clients, which is a tremendously high number of clients that they have, both for mental health and the health department. And we previously had a contract out to try and create an electronic system through that would combine mental health and the health department, and there were a lot of issues that we had with it. This funding actually covers that and an additional amount of funding so that we can put a new RFP out to find a new contractor that would be able to finalize creating an electronic system for their records that we currently don't have.
I will ask your question. Do you have any idea of when that might actually be in place then?
So I know that they are putting the RFP. This would allow us to get the funding. They'd be putting the RFP out in the next month. And I don't know the turnaround for that RFP, but the last project, and Joe, you can give an update of this, that was out for over 6 months, correct?
Yeah, I'd say this could go as long as a year by the time it's fully operational. Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that they talked about is that oftentimes there are electronic systems for mental health that are out-of-the-box systems. This was a question that Will asked. But there are not systems, out-of-the-box systems for the health department. So the hope in the ideal sense is in the ideal situation would be that we would get a system that would function for both departments and allow for an easy exchange between departments. But the RFP will be written so that companies can make bids on both or one or the other, because it may be the case that the ideal scenario isn't that we try and consolidate them both. So it'll be diverse in that, or it'll be flexible in that way.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Anna.
You're welcome.
Let's go to Facilities and Infrastructure Committee. David McKenna is the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. F and I met Tuesday, July 11th, and we have one outstanding resolution. As resolution F 2017 budget neutral adjustment for contribution to defund ID 7099, and I so move.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dooley. Discussion? Ready to vote? Those in favor, please raise your hand. Any opposed? That's unanimous.
Okay, beyond that, we passed several resolutions that were on tonight's agenda, and also had a discussion of the various highway department projects that are in process. One note that I would make is that the East Hill intersection project and Ellis Hollow 3 are going to be sort of put on hold because they're going to put a water line, I believe, down through that intersection. So before they make those changes and finish those projects up. They want to let the water line get in place first. And I would say, although I haven't been there in about a week, the Red Mill Bridge must be almost ready to open. That's my report.
Questions? Thank you, Dave.
I forgot to mention two things in my report, if you can give me one moment.
Oh, you got one chance. Go ahead.
Two other things that I wanted to mention, just in case there are people who don't know, that the temporary assistance funding maximum is $400 for an individual. That's the money that's given if you qualify, maximum. And that is what is causing a lot of the tension, because there's such a crunch in housing. And housing prices are inflated in this county. $400 doesn't go very far, because the houses in the city have already been claimed. It's not that there is fewer houses available in the city. It's just that they're already filled, which as that because they're filled and new ones aren't necessarily being added in, that's what pushes a lot of the housing out of the city. And it seems that all that's available is out of the city and into the more rural communities and other municipalities. It goes up to 542 for a two-person household. But I just wanted people to get a sense of that, how small it actually is. It would be great if we could encourage the state to increase that. But I don't know if that's going to be really likely unless we get NYSAC involved to make a huge push. The last quick thing is that it takes 45 days to process cases for temporary assistance in SNAP. So just to give a sense of what the experience is like, that's puts it in perspective.
Okay. Our Transportation Committee will meet on, what, the 27th, is it, at 10 o'clock, and we will, sorry, 24th, excuse me, Monday, and we will be taking up ride-hailing again. Mm-hmm. And we should have a presentation from the folks from Lyft at that meeting. Questions? Government Operations, Dan Klein is chair. Didn't hear it.
I do have a question. We got a contract from Lyft, which I assume was related to their proposal to do service at the airport. Was that correct? What is the process? Is that approved by the airport, or who has the authority to accept that contract?
The airport manager was negotiated that.
Okay. And it's my understanding there was not a comparable contract from Uber. Is that correct?
Yes. We've approached Uber. As I understand it, they have not responded.
Okay, thank you.
Anna?
There was a discussion of a possible presentation or a discussion or meeting with Lyft. Is that something that is still being looked into so that we can talk to them about?
Well, they're coming to the transportation meeting.
Oh, so they are. Are
they're
they presenting? They are.
We believe they're making a presentation to us, yes. Okay. They've asked to do that. Okay. There's a lot of wheels in this ride-hailing thing, I'll tell you. Dooley?
If the ride-hailing service is obliged to have a contract with the airport but Uber does not have one, how can they legally operate in our county?
They cannot legally operate at the airport.
That's in our county.
I can only tell you what Albany is doing. And they're going to arrest the Uber drivers who drop off fares at the airport and give them some kind of a DMV ticket. I don't know exactly what that's about, but that's what the newspaper reports have reported. Wow. Let's go to budget, capital, and personnel. Is that right? Sorry, GO.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You started, Gio.
You did. You did start. Our next meeting is Wednesday, August 2nd at 3:30 here in these chambers. We will be discussing the blue cards again. We will be discussing the shared service agreement. And we will potentially be discussing the public administration fellowship. Plus, I think there will be more jot and tittles to come. Rick, did I get that right? I've never heard that one before.
I'm not old enough.
More jot and tittles.
Horse and barn.
Ask Rick. I've never heard this one before.
Let's move right along.
That's it. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Dan. Any other questions? Will.
So tonight, as the meeting was beginning, I was handed a sheet from Paul Rossi, who comes to my meetings, and he was telling the policies on public speaking at the other county bodies that he goes. It was very illustrative. We actually have among the most open and accessible of any. But at any rate, I pass it on to you. I think we should get that out to everybody.
Yeah, they're going to be putting the boxes tomorrow. Okay, anything else, Dan?
No, thank you.
Now let's go to Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee. Jim?
What happened to planning?
Well, you want to report, too? I'm just trying to move us along here, Dooley. Planning, Development, Environmental Quality Committee. Dooley Kiefer is the vice chair.
If Martha were here, I'm sure she would tell you that the next meeting will no doubt be the first Thursday of August. That's all.
Any questions?
Love it, Dooley. Absolutely love it.
Now can I go to budget? Jim Dennis.
You pass my two resolutions. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Budget Committee Chair Bill Jim Dennis? Jail Study Committee, Rich John.
Thank you, Mike. We're going to be meeting this Thursday at 5 o'clock, and I believe we're going to approve minutes. We may then go on to some other items.
And we might meet for 3 hours.
Assessment of the future of the Tompkins County Jail study report has come out from CGR, our consultants. That's the that's the group we hired to look at our jail and the alternatives to incarcerations and population issues that we're trying to examine. They've done a very thorough study. The report is available online for anybody who wants to go see it. You can get there either through CGR's website or the county's and link to the report either way. If any of the legislators want a paper copy who don't have one, the staff have indicated they can prepare one for you. We have set up the meeting that this is the only item going, and we will be getting a report from CGR for about 15 minutes, 20 minutes, maybe up to a half an hour, and then the rest of the meeting will probably be taking public comment. We're going to reverse the order to get the presentation first and then receive public comment. If there's time, we will start the legislators on the committee asking questions, but we will proceed from there. So.
Questions? Rich, I have one. I realize you've got to go through the committee process here discussing this report, but is the committee beginning to talk about or think about how it's going to be presented to the Commission on Corrections?
Well, I'm thinking that we need to apply some cost estimates to the different recommendations because there's a lot of recommendations in the report. So we're going to need to figure out what can we afford to do that's reasonable that can bring the estimates of saved jail beds to a point we can go to the Commission on Corrections. But we need to do that fairly quickly because we have a limited extension of the variance at this point. So we're going to have to communicate with the state fairly soon. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Thank you.
Leslin, do you need a different chair? Is that trouble?
Stretching.
Oh, okay. Looked like there was trouble with the chair.
Yeah. I like my $200,000 chair.
Use the desk. To go with the $110,000 desk.
Desk, yes.
Gotcha.
Took the words out of my mouth. Just my section.
Let's take the minutes of July 6th, please. Dan? Is there a second? Rich? All in favor of the minutes, please raise your hand. Any opposed? We have one opposed. Is there any unfinished business? I'll take a motion to adjourn. Or Mike, you have something?
You mentioned Uber before, and they were going to arrest drivers. I'm
sorry?
Remember what you said before, that the Uber drivers would get arrested or whatever? The state was talking about that?
No, the airport in Albany is talking about that.
So who would do? I mean, would the state?
I think I can answer. What Albany's doing is they have the sheriff's department is giving warnings for 30 days, and then they're going to ticket Uber drivers who come to the airport unless they have an agreement by that time.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Don't go to the airport.
I'll take that motion.
No Ubering. I'll be dropping people off the plane.
Get a motion. Moved by Dan, seconded by Anna. All in favor of adjourning.
All in favor of adjourning.
Thank you. Kathy Covert, Michelle Podorf, Marsha Lynch, Jim Blizzard, all of you.
They're individual letters.
Yeah. I will give them credit.